kids, it's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining as usual, Cole, how are you doing?
I'm not dead, so that's a positive.
I thought you'd be a little more upbeat and excited for this one.
I am, but I'm trying to temper myself. We can't, like, throw our cards out at the beginning of the show and be like, we got fucking guests from the Flame and the Flood in Canada, and well, here we are. Now I've done it. God damn it, Joe. Hi, guests.
Hello. I didn't realize that you were such a fan. That's awesome. This is actually really cool because usually you have to understand, usually people open with like, she made BioShock Infinite, also some indie games, but you just glossed right over that.
Oh, yeah. I forgot all about BioShock.
No, I love it. I love it.
So I have to go ahead and lay it on the line. Because yeah. The Flame and the Flood is one of my top five games of all time.
Do you want to introduce her first?
I just want to tell her how I'm like in love with her work I am. Would you like to introduce her since you're the host?
From Chump Squad, Gwen Frey, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm very excited right now, actually. This is an exciting podcast. It's cool to meet a true fan here.
Yes. I don't joke around when I say The Flame and the Flood is literally like one of my most favorite games ever. I think I have 300 or 400 hours in it.
Wow.
And I was playing it just before we started the interview because I was like, I haven't played it in a while and it's time.
That is beautiful. Do you play it on the Switch or the PC?
I play it on the Xbox.
Oh, wow. Bucking the trend. I love it.
Yeah. I'm a diehard Xbox player. I say that, but I've been playing on my PC more the last few months. Everybody's giving me grief over that. But the funny part is I play my Xbox games on my PC.
Yeah. You just stream it through.
It's just because I don't want to have to turn around to look at the TV. Everything else is right here.
So you mean you plug your Xbox into your computer monitor? Is that your setup?
No, there's a console companion app, and you can literally stream what's going on your Xbox to that app, and it displays on your computer.
Huh.
And I was actually streaming The Flame and the Flood, which is, I don't stream a whole lot, although I'm getting better about it. But I was like, I don't have a capture card because I don't stream much. And so that's the way I learned to like get around not paying $300 for a capture card was just stream it to the app and then capture it from there.
Oh man.
So it's kind of a roundabout way to do it, but it's effective. So, and it's free. And I like free. But I was playing it right before we started, and I realized that some of the achievements had been fixed, and I could finally complete the game. Yeah, I've been sitting at 870 forever, and I kept playing it, even though the achievements were broken and I couldn't complete it. I was sad
that is a big deal for her to actually play a game without achievements being on the line.
It's true. It's true. Oh. I don't do it much.
They definitely, some people, it's strange. For some people, those achievements matter a great deal. And for some people, they don't matter at all. And I don't really know many in between. I don't know many people who are like, oh, I really like them, but they're not there. Oh, that's fine. Like, I don't, people seem very, very excited about achievements. Especially a lot of console gamers. I don't see it as much on PC. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all hearsay. It's all just people I know and what I read from feedback and stuff like that. But definitely, when the achievements were broken, we heard about that quite loudly from the console gamers.
I remember the first time I did the 40 days without eating meat, and then it was broken, and I just sat and cried. I was just like, I had a 400-day endless run.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what that was called, because you have to keep in mind, so it's not like I made the Flame in the Flood.
Yeah.
I was a co-founder at a studio that made the Flame in the Flood. There were six of us total on that project. And I remember initially one of the achievements, I don't think it was called vegetarian. It was called Animal Friend. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep in mind the individual that came up with this achievement is vegan. Mm-hmm. So we had some serious conversations about what it takes to be Animal Friend in the Flame in the Flood at first.
Because you need a lot of the animal resources just to do most basic stuff.
Mm-hmm. And so are you an animal's friend? It became a whole conversation, really. But man, that was a while ago. Mm-hmm. It's weird. It feels like ages ago, and that really wasn't that long ago.
Well, time has no meaning during this pandemic.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we're going to retcon 2020 entirely, which is a shame because it was a good year, but only for me. And I'm willing to give that up. I'm willing to say that, for the greater good of the world.
Well, tell us about what happened good in year 2020.
Oh, I got married.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. That's basically it. Very boring stuff. The life stuff happened. But yeah,
welcome to the club. Going on like 15 years. Cole, how many you got?
February will make 20.
Damn.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I don't sound like hurts. It, huh? I don't sound like somebody that could have been married for 20 years, but here I am. You also had another game that you worked on since The Flame in the Flood.
So
you want to tell us about that?
Sure. I co-founded The Flame in the Flood with several people. And then I exited that company to found my own studio solo, which I completely own, which is Chump Squad, which is where I am now. And I did that to create a game called Kine. This was kind of a huge passion project of mine that I was obsessed with. It was something I was working on at home. It was a narrative puzzle game. It's about these three little machines that dream of being musicians, and it's how they meet up and form a band. And it's a story about them meeting up and forming a band, but it's told entirely through puzzles. Very difficult spatial puzzles that you have to complete in 3D space. So this was a weird game. It was my first game that I made as a creative director, like as the primary developer. And it was a very personal project. It was something that, I was the only programmer. I was, for the PC SKU, I had help for the consoles. I was the only designer. I directed the art. I did the first pass of basically everything in the game. It was a solo project up until about the last year.
Wow.
So this game was like very, very near and dear to my heart. And yeah, I launched it last year. I launched it in November last year. I launched it on most platforms in October of last year and on Google Stadia on November of last year. Stadia didn't come out till November.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But how's it been performing since release?
Depends on the platform, but I'm pretty happy with things. I'm extremely happy with the response in general.
Did Xbox let you down? Did we let you down on the Xbox side?
Given the situation in the world today, I am not going to disparage any given platform.
Come on, Xboxers, get your shit together.
The reality of being an independent game developer is I need to be able to work with whichever platform will give me money or will support me in whatever way they can. And so it's not really smart to go around and be like, this platform or that platform is a problem, especially because, in reality, I think what Xbox is doing is very intelligent right now. As far as the doing two different console SKUs, it's a weird move, but that's a weird and interesting move. And the having a Game Pass, focusing so heavily on Game Pass is a interesting move. That could very rapidly create a walled garden. So I don't think it's a really good time to piss off Microsoft. Would be the way to put that.
Which console have you seen the best sales on? Most people would imagine the Switch.
I mean, I'm not allowed to say.
I didn't know if you were allowed to say the best or not.
I guess I can. Yeah, it's the Switch.
Most games seem to do really well on the Switch. That just seems to be like the indie devs' headquarters anymore.
Yeah, the Switch is a I mean, it's one of my favorite platforms, to be fair. Like, I
Cole
like
Cole has a Switch now. Haha.
I do, but I don't ever play it.
You should.
I only play games on PC, really. And if I have a console, it's because it's the Switch, so that I can travel with it in the past, so I could travel with it now, so that, like, most of my gaming will be at my PC, maybe at my laptop downstairs if I'm hanging out with my man, or maybe the Switch downstairs if I can't get it on PC. And it fits better with a controller, you know what I mean?
But, yeah, the couple times I've played the Switch, I've had to use... We have one of the controllers that looks like an Xbox controller. Mm-hmm. And because apparently my hands at this point are just like glued to the Xbox shape.
Oh, yeah.
I can't handle anything else.
I can't blame you. I'm not a fan of that controller. I will say I was weird... I use an Xbox controller for everything, but I do like the weight of the Stadia controller. I think the one... Ooh, let me rephrase that. A thing that Stadia did right was their controller. It is actually a really nice controller. The
golden robots are watching.
Yeah. I honestly have not held a Stadia controller. What is it like?
I'm gonna pick it up. Hold on. Well, it's like an Xbox controller. It feels slightly more symmetrical, and it's just... I'm going to pick up my Xbox controller, too. It's just a little bit heavier, and it just sits in my hands a little bit nicer. I can't explain it. It's hard to say.
So the added weight is what you like about it?
Yeah, it's got like a little bit of added weight that I like, and I don't know. I do like the symmetry of it. Mind you...
Oh, it has symmetrical analog sticks. I'm not a fan of those. That's... One of the reasons I'm not a PlayStation fan, I'm just not a fan of the symmetrical sticks. I like the offset.
Yeah. See, that was the one thing. I like the Xbox controller, but I wish they had the symmetrical sticks. Mm. I mean, it might depend on what kind of game you play, to be honest. But yeah, I prefer this. And the Stadia was just like this happy middle ground. And yeah, I do like the weight to it. I don't know. It's got like just a little bit more weight to it.
That's why I like the Xbox Elite controller. It has that added heft to it with like the metal parts. It just It feels like you could club someone and hurt them really bad.
Yeah, we got one of those too. It takes
That is my one complaint about my Elite controller is that it's heavy. But in all fairness, where I have rheumatoid disease, so my hands are jacked up anyway.
I see.
And so like the weight of it causes extra fatigue quicker. That's why I often when I play, it's one reason why I started like streaming things to the computer to play it is so that I could lay my hands on my desk with my controller rather than just trying to hold it up. I could just lay them down and have them still be kind of elevated while I play. But
lucky I'm fat. I have that shelf of my gut that I could just rest my arms on.
I mean, I'm fat too, but I don't got enough help to hold up my controller.
Just recline back, lay the controller on your chest. Oh, my Lord. Yeah, this is an awful show. I don't know why you're here, Gwen, but thank you for coming. How are you doing?
I'm getting by in these days. I'm keeping busy. I think that's really that's the best thing to do these days. I'm keeping quite busy.
And what are you keeping busy with? Tell us about the current project you are working on.
Oh, yeah. So I launched Kine in October/November last year. Like Stadia was November. I started another project for a couple months, kind of got a little bit burnt out on that, set that aside, and I was going to do a quick game jam. I swore after Kine I wouldn't do... I didn't swear. I figured after Kine, I should probably do something that's a little bit more market viable than a narrative puzzle game. If you watch if you follow the indie scene and stuff and you see what tends to sell, you'll see that it's very difficult to sell a single player game in general. Like, it's just very difficult because a lot of the... A lot of the success in indie development happens on the Switch for sure, but those games are usually find success first on Steam and then move over to the Switch. And the way you find success on Steam is by having a game that's highly replayable, because Steam is always showing you, here's what your friends are playing, or here's the games that people are playing the most right now. Steam's storefront, as a general rule, doesn't really surface games that are short and good so much as it surfaces games that are highly replayable and good.
Yeah.
Also, there's just there's just something really compelling about highly replayable games. There's a lot of value in them as far as how much, you know, game you're getting for your money. The Flame in the Flood is a highly replayable game that people can go back to. And I know that logically, even though I personally prefer shorter experiences and narrative experiences, I also love strategy games and tactics games and games that are highly replayable. And I swore that I would go make one of those next, and stop pursuing these kind of shorter narrative titles. But then
you made a shorter narrative puzzle.
Yeah, you know,
there's value in that, even though that's not the kind of game that gets, pushed to the forefront often. There's plenty of people. I mean, I play games like that all the time. If you tell me I can knock out a game in an hour and it's a narrative experience, I'm like, hold on, let me put my feet up. You know? So, there's value to it. It's just that there's marketing doesn't see the value in it.
It's a lot of work to market a game like that. It's just a lot more work to market a game like that. It doesn't market itself in the same way. And marketing sucks.
Yes.
This stuff in general is just soul crushing and draining. Like, I hate it. And I didn't want to have to climb that hill again. But what I did do was, it was March. The project I was working on wasn't really going anywhere. I wasn't going anywhere yet. It was time to start pitching it for funding and to try to secure some sort of investment so I could grow the studio and not just be a solo developer. And it was March, the coronavirus was starting, and I knew I couldn't fly around and pitch it. And so I just took a break and I did a quick game jam with a niche puzzle designer named Lucas Lislo. He's a, because I made Kine, I know way too many people who are these niche puzzle designers now. Like, I'm way too involved in that community. It's a blessing because I love those guys, and it's a curse because now I keep making these games.
I like how he's credited as beloved experimental puzzle designer on your site.
He's beloved. I don't know. I had to choose I liked his, I could say a lot about Lucas. He's great. He's fantastic. I like working with him a lot, but we started a game jam and it got out of control, as these things do. We started a game jam. We started thinking we would make something funny about the coronavirus, which in hindsight, like, just saying that out loud sounds awful. We thought we would make something like, oh, you're social distancing in a grocery store, see? And you use a shopping cart. And if you get too close to somebody, they cough on one side of the shopping cart and it's infected. And then if you touch it, you die. And I was like, we started making this. And then it was like, oh, this is a real thing in the world. And this is actually a serious topic. And we really can't be funny about this at all. And as that became more and more evident, we scrapped that project.
And you know, the odd thing about that is now we kind of feel like, oh, we can't make these kind of jokes about coronavirus. But if you ever stop and think about it, like, Ring Around the Rosie was a song kids sung about the plague. So we have a long history of, as human beings, of like dark comedy and nursery rhymes from really horrible shit.
Yeah.
It's true.
So don't feel bad if that was where your thought process was going, because, like, that's just what I think that's one of the ways we cope with shit like this.
Yeah. But, like, I already hate marketing.
Yeah.
And the last thing I want to do is go explain why this is an acceptable game to make to a bunch of people. Like, yeah. I wasn't feeling it. Like, I reached a point where I wasn't feeling it. And so we scrapped that. We took the code base for that, which was like an amalgamation of this kind of like tactical shooter thing that I was working on. And now this other quick game jam that we made in about 2 weeks, and we repurposed it, and we started slowly developing what became Lab Rat. This is a mashup of a couple projects. There's also another side project I had started where I was trying to make something funny about the election, where, as you fill out this kind of like this poll, you know how polls can be manipulated and data can be manipulated to just say the opposite. It was supposed to be a joke about how that's happening. And I just couldn't quit. That didn't come together either. That was like a 1 week project I had tried, but I had tech from that where I had all these Likert polls and this stuff that would allow you to have real polls with real people, and would feed into Steam's backend and record everybody's responses. And so I kind of folded that into the game as well. And that's that. This kind of combination of ideas shaped into what is now LabRat. LabRat is this narrative puzzle game about this machine learning algorithm that's trying to create a puzzle game, basically. And it's constantly polling you, asking you for feedback, and it's constantly misinterpreting what you say in different ways and coming to darker and darker conclusions about humanity. And in a way that's funny and that kind of evokes the same sort of, just in a way that's funny, in a way that's a little bit maybe reminiscent of Portal, because I did love that game quite a bit.
I am looking at some of the screenshots on the site with the question asking how much did you enjoy the previous puzzle, with the responses being a lot, a whole lot, and it was, no joke, one of the best experiences of my life. And that seems to very much go in line with what our current administration thinks. It's like, how are we doing? Fantastic, amazing, the best job ever. Those are the choices.
Yeah. Well, we're still in the, like, halfway through development of LabRat. Like, we're still figuring, finding its voice and that sort of thing. And I do want to keep this to being something light, something that's not super talking about specifically what the, how I put it. I want to make people laugh. That's
an escape. Here.
Yeah. I don't think I want to make something heavy. I don't think I want to talk about the current administration in any way. I don't mind at all poking fun at data and how data is manipulated. I'd love to talk about tech. I'd love to point out the absurdity of the world today. A huge part of my motivation for LabRat was this feeling that I felt right now when I sit here and I'm at my computer, and the only way I ever talk to other human beings is filtered through this software, is filtered through this machine that is profiling everything I do and judging me and putting me into a filter bubble. And every time I search for things on Google, it's assumptions are being made about me. And I did want to capture that in a way that, capture that, shine a light on it, and kind of point out how absurd it is and this shared experience that we have today. And that's why a lot of the stuff you see in LabRat, a lot of the polls, some of them are extremely silly, like the one you just mentioned. But there's other ones as well, and you can always see what other people respond. You can always kind of see feedback for how other people are playing the game. When you complete a puzzle, you see stats for how many other people completed, like what percentage of people completed that puzzle and that sort of thing. Because I do want to capture this idea that we're having a shared experience right now, that we're all in this together, but we're all super separate. There was something about that that I found incredibly compelling.
That's really cool. I notice on some of these screenshots how it mentions like 10 responses recorded, or like 4 people have played this level. What kind of numbers are you looking at right now? Like, has it been in testing for a while?
Oh, no. The only people who have played this game right now are on the dev team. So I think I've given out about 30 keys total, and mostly to developers, to the developers that are working on the project, of which there's 5 of us, I think. If you include the contractor that's doing audio, and friends to test so far, just friends and family testing. I plan to have a closed beta in probably about 2 months.
What kind of release window are you looking at with this, or is it still too early to tell?
I'm hoping to launch in Q1 next year.
Q1.
Yeah,
that's a pretty quick turnaround.
The first 3 months of next year. Yeah, I mean, I got nothing else going on, though, so...
We're all locked in our houses anyway. Might as well make a game.
Yeah, it's like, honestly, in a way, I kind of want to, how do I put it? I definitely don't want to launch before then, not only because it wouldn't be a good, I don't think I could hit the quality bar I want that quickly, but also just because I would like to have something that I'm aggressively trying to finish through the winter this year. Just to keep me very distracted through the winter. It's about to come up.
I think we're all going to need to be very distracted this winter.
Just a little. To be fair.
So that's good planning on your part.
Yeah. Yeah, the goal is to lose my mind trying to crunch on this game through the winter so that I'm not losing my mind on every other imaginable thing. That's honestly the plan.
Nose to the grindstone, ignore the rest of the world, just focus on the game. That's all you got to do.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And I wish I could do that. I wish I had something to just take me away from life right now. Oh, wait, I do. Kingdoms of Amalur. Hello, Kingdoms of Amalur. How are you doing?
I was about to say, what about the podcast?
What about the podcast? I mean, come on.
We're sitting here doing a distraction right now.
Yeah.
I think how much he appreciates our efforts.
I think it's harder to distract yourself with something that's, how do I put it? There's certain tasks that I feel like you can't just sit down and do for 12 hours straight. For me, it's things like writing. Like, I can't sit down and just write forever. It's a creative task. You need to, it uses a certain amount of creative energy that needs to be replenished. Whereas if you've got, like, for me at least, if it's something that I'm drawing, if it's something that's creative in a more visual way, I can just sit down and do that for 12 hours straight and the day will fly. And I can crank through a list of work. You know what I mean?
No.
I think a part of that is when it comes to writing, like, it has to be legible for somebody else to understand it. And when it comes to, like, drawing, if you put a brush stroke down of green paint in the middle of your pink canvas, then you just get to go, well, it was a creative decision, and roll with it. And you kind of can't get away with that with writing.
Maybe. I mean, I think they're both subjective. So I don't know if I agree with that. I think with writing, it's just the raw coming up with the idea.
Yeah.
Whereas with drawing or with a lot of the things that I can do for 12 hours, it's more execution of the idea. And there's only so much you can do the raw coming up with the idea versus the execution of the idea. You can, once you know what you're doing and your hands are just doing it and you're just focused on doing it, that's just, you can get into a flow state in a way that I don't know if I could ever really get into that kind of flow state when it's coming up with ideas. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I think the idea aspect is definitely the whole brainstorming and all that is, well, shit, I know I struggle with it because I have an art gallery showing at the end of the month and I have done exactly zero pieces for it. So.
Proud of like you.
Like, I'll immediately click and be like, no, this is what I'm going to draw. And then I will sit there and paint for 3 days straight and not take a break and then whine and bitch that my hands hurt. Mm-hmm. But, like, getting to the point where I'm like, what am I going to draw? Finding the wall between what am I going to draw and this is what I'm drawing. And then getting over that wall is a bitch is what I'm trying to say.
Yes. You've basically nailed it. That's the part that you cannot rush. That's the part that you can't do by crunching or anything like that. But, you know, that's just the thing that takes a certain amount of time on the calendar. And it sucks.
Yeah, the gallery showing's the last Friday and I'll be here like Thursday, like the waiting for the ink to dry. Somebody get me a hair dryer so I can blow dry this painting a little quicker.
I gotta go take it
to submission.
You procrastinator.
Yeah.
That was the same way in high school. I always waited till the last day to do anything and I always got an A. So suck it, teachers. You didn't know what I was doing.
No, there's an interesting quirk with procrastination like that, where like when you're a creative person, you tend to like get into that crunch zone and your brain just flows a little more freely with ideas at that time because you're just in a panic state of, oh my God, what do I do? And there's something about the adrenaline hit that is what finally fuels it to go.
And that's why we have good interviews, because we're under the stress of what's going on. So it turns into a good interview. Everyone's laughing, having a good time. And then we go to the normal show and it's terrible.
I have rip roaring anxiety. So yes. I don't know that any of it goes well. We have discussed this before. I keep an anxiety puke bucket under the desk. It's a stressful thing.
We've got our shit together. So, yeah. You mentioned being in the zone when you're creating, with Kine, that was a very musical game. Are you a very musical person? Is there a certain soundtrack that fuels your life?
Not that fuels my life, but generally there's a lot of times there's a song that inspires me to start making something, or I'll have a playlist for any game that I'm working on, for instance. I will say that Lab Rat is the one time I don't have that, but definitely for Kine, I was heavily inspired by La La Land. I just absolutely loved that film. And I remember that was an amalgamation of things where I was like, okay, I really like this sort of movement mechanic that I came up with, and I want to make puzzles out of this, but I also want to capture a feeling. The feeling I want to capture is the feeling I felt when I was watching La La Land, of struggling musicians trying to make it, of how difficult it is to find your way in life, but how the struggle is also kind of beautiful, and that just everything about that film, the color, the vibe of it just really appealed to me. And I just wanted to make a game that felt like that. So yes, that obviously would seem very musical. And The Flame and the Flood, from the very beginning, we were working with Chuck Reagan and his soundtrack that he wrote exclusively for the game. And we were listening to that when we worked, and that informed the kind of, we knew we wanted to do something that was like Southern Americana. We knew we wanted something that had that sort of vibe and feel. And that soundtrack heavily influenced us as we were working. I think the music you listen to when you work totally changes things.
So with The Flame and the Flood, the music came before the game, or was it kind of a collaboration where, I don't know, what direction did it go? I can't question right now.
Good job, Joe.
Told you I'm good at this.
I like it. Whatever. It's meaties. If that means anything. But for The Flame of the Flood, so that project was obviously a collaboration. And the designer on that one, Forrest, knew we should make, or his vision was to make a survival game. I would say the high-level vision came from probably Forrest and Scott Sinclair. Scott Sinclair was the art director on Bioshock Infinite, and he was the... he has a very distinct art style. We started most likely with, we want to make a game with Scott Sinclair's art style. And then Forrest brought in, it will be a survival game, because we want to survive as a studio, and we should make something that sells. So highly replayable roguelike games do well on Steam right now. Let's do that. And then we were trying to round out how it would feel. That was about when Sync said, hey, I used to jam with somebody named Chuck Reagan, he's an old friend of mine. Let's reach out to him. And so when we did the Kickstarter, we did it with a video that showcased some of Scott Sinclair's work. We had a really quick prototype of what our survival game we hoped it would feel like, set to Chuck Reagan's music. And so all three of those things kind of came together at the same time.
That's really cool. I didn't realize The Flame and the Flood was on Kickstarter.
Yeah, we kickstarted that. We actually got that Kickstarter together very quickly. We were laid off in February. Is that right? I think we were officially laid off at the end of February, early March, but we got our, like, that was when they told us it was coming, because they have to tell you a month in advance. And then we stopped having any, like, being able to go into the office, and we were told, you know, you're done here in April. And the Kickstarter was in the fall.
That wasn't a too bad of a turnaround at all.
No, we managed to get that Kickstarter together pretty quickly. And that was how we funded development. Because The Flame and the Flood, when we launched, we were a self-published game. We self-published that on Steam and on the Xbox. And we did it within 2 years. So it was a pretty quick turnaround game.
So, Cole, what kind of questions do you have about The Flame and the Flood now that you have the opportunity?
I've already learned so much, like why the whole vegan achievement was there and everything. Like, I'm not even going to lie. I was sitting here, like, you asked that question, and I was like, I don't know how to ask another question. I'm just sitting here kind of starry-eyed with my hands on my cheeks to talk.
Gwen, has anyone ever fangirled like this during an interview before?
I mean, not over The Flame and the Flood. So I am deeply enjoying this. You have to understand, like, the game of Bioshock Infinite, I'm really proud of my work on that, but I was one of a small team. Or sorry, I was one small part of a large team there, right?
What was your role on Bioshock Infinite, by the way?
No, we're so not talking about Bioshock.
No, we can't.
Go ahead. I just wanted to get after Joe.
Mean. <Okay.
laughs> So on Bioshock Infinite, I was a senior technical animator, and I was given an incredible amount of freedom there. My job was to come up with background characters. Specifically, we had the character models, but what are people doing in this world? Populate the world, make it feel lively, come up with... And so I would get a scene like, okay, there's a beach. We're going to have five people in a row doing jumping jacks, and we're going to... I would come up with things for people to do, and I would send that out with the producer to go get mo-capped, and then I'd bring it into the game, and I'd ask the writers to write some dialogue for them, and it was a combination of different things. It was a kind of coming up with what would be there. It was also implementing it, organizing all of these kind of background characters. It was scripting them so that they would, like, if you get close to a background character, they head track you. After a certain amount of time, maybe they say a line, like all the narrative scripting for the background scenes, that sort of thing. That was a huge part of my role. And then there was the other side of my role, which was like technical, more raw technical animation. Like I did the cloth dynamics for Liz's skirt, for instance. Mm. And all the secondary motion in Elizabeth, or the rag dolls in the characters when they die and that sort of thing.
I love ragdoll physics.
Creating the ragdolls has to be the best job ever. Just to watch them. Everybody gets tickled when a body ragdolls, and it's just insane.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of ragdolls are fun. You get, it's weird because I'll see these people will post like, look at this hilarious bug. And I'm like, that's not funny. That's really easy to have happen. And clearly there's what they did wrong. Like the humor's gone. Like the joy there is gone. It's been gone forever. And it's weird. You talk about ragdolls when they're fun, and like all I can think of is just
this is the code that would have fixed that. Yeah.
Like I'm not a programmer, and I was working with a system that was not great. Like there was only so much I could do. We could never make those ragdolls look not stupid. I just didn't have the ability to. Like, I'm not the one that wrote the system. We're working with a physics system that's integrated in the Unreal Engine, and I'm doing the best I can with this thing. Like, so I'm not, like, super proud of the ragdolls in Bioshock Infinite. Basically, there's no joy there. Let's go back to talking about the Flame of the Flood.
Yeah, Cole, what questions do you have about Flame of the Flood?
There are no ragdolling physics.
There are no ragdolls.
You just fucking die.
That's goddamn right. Yeah. I didn't want to deal with that shit. So buggy. Ragdolls are so buggy. Physics in general is just... I mean, I imagine I would enjoy it more if I was somebody who could dive into the code and had the desire to dive into the code and make physics work good, but I'm not, and it just never hit the quality bar. So...
Were the animations something that you worked on for the Flame of the Flood?
Oh, yeah. So for the Flame of the Flood, my role was very different. Like on Bioshock Infinite, I didn't animate at all. For the Flame of the Flood, there was only three artists, which mm-hmm. I was one of them. And I did all the effects and all the animations.
Wow.
And the rigging and the technical animation stuff and some shader stuff, though a lot of the environment shader stuff was all very much Chad, not me. But all the character stuff, basically, was my job.
My husband messaged me, and I just lost my question because I read his. Uh-huh. Fuck, you're distracted.
Get off your phone while you're doing
Not
it.
Not on my phone. I have two monitors.
Stop playing the Flame in the Flood while you're doing an interview.
Okay, now that I'm guilty of.
Currently or during other interviews? Little column A, little column B.
I mean, to be fair, it's over here. It's on. It's just paused. I'm a decent person.
You're doing research. Sometimes. That's
what I was doing.
Yeah, yesterday. You had an excuse right there.
I needed a refresher. It had been a while. And then I'm very proud of myself because it took me a little bit to remember the controls, but I didn't die immediately on stream and embarrass myself. So I was like, fuck yeah. I'm the queen of Flame in the Flood.
So, Cole, you said you had like a 400-day run. Gwen, what's the longest run that staff had or that like you know of? Has there been any just ridiculously long runs of that game?
Man, it's been a while. So I'm not sure. Like, I definitely never had a 400 day run, just heads up. So you've done better than I have.
Beat the dev.
I don't think I'm the, definitely Forrest has done better than me though, as far as how long the run goes. As far as who the, I'd have to ask Forrest. I think somebody's made it a couple years before though. Like one very, I'm pretty sure somebody made it like at least 2 years. Wow. So I don't want to be quoted on that.
You said it.
We'll consult the internet. We'll consult the internet. Forrest will know.
Somebody will yell at us if we're wrong.
And no one's going to listen to this. It's okay. We're good.
Good point.
Oof. It's on Kotaku. That's how we Kotaku's outing us. They're going to print all these lies about the Flame of the Flood. It's going to be all my fault. No, I don't want to misrepresent the game because it's a weird situation because I loved that game while I was working on it, and I was a part of founding that studio, and I co-owned that studio with those guys. But then I left, and they're still making games, and they're doing incredible work. The Blasted Flood just launched Drake Hollow.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
I'm also very into Drake Hollow. I've already put an obscene amount of time there, too.
There's so much game in that game. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so much game in that game. I'm trying to come up with my elevator pitch when I talk to it to other people, but I didn't work on that title, so I don't really have like the sat down like, all right, it's a village builder. Basically, you play with friends, you run around, you collect stuff, you fight stuff. Your goal is to get the drakes to be happy, healthy, you know, full. You build it. It's got base building. It's got combat. The combat's actually not bad. The coolest part to me is the part where you're like going with your friends and putting up these building these kind of, I don't know how to describe it, this kind of like network of
waypoints.
Things.
Yeah. The waypoints have like a crystal beam between them, and you can actually ride on them like you're grinding on a skateboard.
Which I totally dig. Mm-hmm. Like, I love all of it. It's a cool game to play. I dig it.
It was funny because I was playing it with a friend who is very like adamant that he hates most games. And he was playing it with me, and there were a couple times where when we weren't playing, he'd send a message and be like, are we playing Drake Hollow today? And I was like, what? Who are you? And we actually finished it together, and it was a huge surprise because he's not the person to play that
kind good old of prayer hub.
Yeah, it was Lightspeed.
I will not recognize the name Lightspeed until he changes his name back to Lightspeed.
I don't know when it's ever going to release his name for change back, so he's stuck with it being Prayer Hub. he committed to a bad joke he can't get away from.
Don't change your name on Twitch, kids, unless you really mean it.
But were there any challenges? It looks like Lab Rat is like a 3D kind of top-down puzzler, mm-hmm. whereas I know it's Kine, and I keep wanting to say Kine because somebody told me it was Kine, and I was like, no, it's Kine, and now I'm stuck with it. Uh-huh. But whereas Kine was like a more of a 2D animation kind of art style, were there any kind of changes or challenges with changing up that art style for you?
That's funny because Kine is very much more of a 3D puzzle game in that like there's a 3D grid and you're doing stuff on 3D space, whereas Lab Rat is way more top down as far as the gameplay goes.
So it feels more 2D even though it's visually 3D.
I don't know. I think so. It's hard to say. What is it? Oh, I think it feels more 3D because it looks more 3D, but in reality, if you just break out the gameplay, it is by far way more 2D. Whereas mm-hmm. Kine was very, very much 3D. It was very much about manipulating an object in like a Tetris shape in 3D space. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it is interesting how the art style changes things. And I think the reason there was different reasons for why Kine looks the way it does. I wanted that. I wasn't going for a 2D art style necessarily. In fact, I think that's probably a negative because flattening the world is not a good thing if you want people to really comprehend 3D space. But I did want a sketchy art style because there is a lot of negative space in Khan, mm-hmm. and you need to be able to jump over gaps and things like that. And it's difficult to sense the grid or the distance of things if you, or how things line up with all this negative space around. And so if I made a sketchy art style, I could have a line, I could just throw a line in the world that extended beyond the edge of the world and guided your eye so you could see, oh, this is where that is on the grid. If I jump over this gap, here's where I'll land. And so the sketchy art style in Khan was very intentional it was an intentional effort to help you feel the grid in 3D space. That was less necessary in Lab Rat. Also, another side of that was when I began Khan, I was a solo developer. And so there was, before it had all the pretty boxes and things in there that it has now, now the environment's beautiful, but initially it was a much more simplified version of what it was. And having that kind of flat shaded look was a lot more attainable for a solo developer. So for Lab Rat, I started this solo, but I have a friend who is incredible in environments. He was the lead level builder on Bioshock Infinite. And we agreed to trade time. Like I agreed to animate for his game if he would come in and do some hours doing environment artwork on my game. Like we traded, I think, 9 hours. And in 9 hours, he came in and like did a pass and made this game look beautiful and very 3D with an art style that I think is more, how would I put it? More AAA feeling, kind of.
It has a very polished look to it.
Yeah, definitely.
Higher production value look, I guess would be the way I would put it. He would put it in a much more intelligent way. I think he would call it something like super realism, hyper realism. He likes to take something that's very realistic, but then push it, not in a way that's stylized and feels like a mobile phone, but in a way that feels... He likes to push on color and brightness and more so than shape. Whereas like Khan obviously was super cartoony and pushed on shape a lot mm-hmm. and played around a lot with scale. He tends to play a lot more with color and contrast and that sort of thing. Hmm. But yeah, I'm a huge fan of Snite's work. I think he does great.
I think it's awesome that you guys traded time like that so you both got what you needed for your games. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
What game did you work on for them?
Yeah, that was the part I was going to say. So that was the initial agreement, and he did the work for my game, and then they actually canceled their game. So we're renegotiating now. No, he's spinning up a new one, so I think if this next game pans out, then I will do the animation for that. And in the meantime, I just paid him to make up for it.
That works.
Yeah.
So we've been talking a lot about the games that you created. What kind of games are you playing right now? Is there anything that came out that you're really into or anything coming out that you're looking forward to?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the game that just came out that I'm playing right now is Monsters Expedition by Alan Hazelden. Alan's just incredible puzzle designer. I told you I'm like way too into these niche puzzle communities now.
Covered that one on our last episode. Our reviewer Aki covered that one, and she really enjoyed that one.
Oh yeah, it's delightful. It's very it's just very chill. It's just a very chill puzzle game that still kind of has a soul. You know, there's a lot of chill kind of puzzle games where you zen out and they're either you enter a flow state or they're very most puzzle games they tend to have this very mechanical, I don't call it boring, how to put it, meditative sort of vibe to them. Whereas this has a bit more of lighthearted and playful vibe to it, which I really appreciate. And a lot of just cute British humor. And it was just extremely well done. I think he did an excellent job with this one. Alan Hazelden and his team.
Nice. What else? Anything else that you're enjoying these days or anything you're looking forward to that's coming out?
Oh, okay.
Do you have any stake in the upcoming console wars? Are you interested in a Series X, a no, Series S, or a PS5?
Dude, I did one of these. I do no research on who I'm talking to before I do it. Just heads up. Like, cause I just got, I put out a press blast about Lab Rat, and then I just accepted every podcast or everything that came up.
Oh, we're sorry. So, we're so sorry.
Yeah,
it's all good. I enjoy this. It helps me. If nothing else, it's practice for me to talk. You know what I mean? No, it like in the worst case scenario, at least I'm getting used to talking about what I'm doing, which is actually really hard. Like, you actually do have to practice that. You think you know what you're doing until you have to describe it to somebody, and you don't want that moment where you're describing it to somebody to be like when you're on camera and talking to Kotaku. You know what I mean? So it's good to do a lot of these, for me at least. If nothing else, it's excellent practice. And also, I'm sure that you have wonderful people to listen to this. And if nothing else, I get to talk to you two wonderful human beings. So it's all good.
If you get nothing else out of this interview, you know that there is one super fangirl over the Flame and the Flood who just is like starry-eyed for the whole hour that we chatted.
Oh, dude, I've got to get you in touch with this, with the whole team. They would love this. Wait, what was the question? I already forgot.
What are you looking forward to, and do you have any stake in the upcoming console wars? Do you have a preference over either of them?
So I did one of these, and I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure the person I was talking to must have been like paid off by Sony or something.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
I'm way out of touch. I'm not sure, because it was definitely very, very pro PS5, and I have to admit, like, just don't give a shit about the next console generation right now. Like, I just fair. Don't see anything
very there. Fair.
Like, I'm looking at it and I'm like, okay, I'm a PC gamer. That's part of the problem. I'm looking at this like, okay, so it's about this percentage as much of power as my PC. That's cool, I guess. The new PS5 controller looks cool. It sounds like it's got haptic feedback, and I've heard that that's incredible, and I'll look forward to trying that at some point. I'm sure I will. Not going to spend $500 to play with your fancy new controller. But, you know, like, we'll see where things go. I don't know what price point Sony's going to come out with something on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then we'll see what the actual price point is. I'm more interested in the kind of meta game that Microsoft is playing, because that could totally upend the industry, right? Like, Game Pass... I do not buy indie games on Xbox anymore because I have so many on Game Pass. Yeah. And like, yeah. That's a thing that we should be really thinking about as indies. That's just the way it's going right now, which means now Microsoft is the gatekeeper, which means like I have to figure out if I want to port Labrat to, if it makes any sense to port Labrat to the console, specifically to the Microsoft console. Unless I know I'm in Game Pass, is there any point at all? Like, that's more where my headspace is at. So he kept asking me about specs on Sony. I'm like, oh shit, I don't even know, man. I'm pretending to like have an opinion. I don't know. Like, it's a new console. I'm sure we've reached the point where games are beautiful. Games will become more beautiful. The games I play tend not to be the ones that are like pushing the limits of how beautiful a game can be. I mean, I played the Naughty Dog titles because I have to as an animator. It's almost like homework. And they are great. Don't get me wrong. I do love the Naughty Dog titles. They are fantastic. But, it's not something I personally want to craft right now. Not anymore. That's just not where I am anymore. I'm much more interested in these indie games. I'm much more interested in A Monster's Expedition. I thought that was fantastic. I spend a lot more time thinking along those lines rather than how many triangles we can draw now. You know what I mean?
I think it's interesting that when people talk about beautiful games, their first thought is to go to something like Horizon Zero Dawn and even Halo 5 at the time and The Last of Us now. And like, your first thought is this hyper-realistic CGI blockbuster, but there's so many indies that are beautiful but have completely unconventional art styles, and they just get glossed over when you're talking about pretty games. And I'm like, there are so many times where I've reviewed a game for the show and like my whole mentality is like, I don't care if it's a $5 game, it's fucking gorgeous.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them that are, and they just get lost in the shuffle because they don't look, like a hyper realistic post-apocalyptic whatever. You know, if I want to see trees, I'll walk outside. I live in the goddamn woods. What I want to see, show me some really cool looking ghosts,
I don't, Yeah, I mean, I don't think the hype, we don't talk about the hyper-realistic games, I don't think. Like, I wouldn't consider, like, the most hyper-realistic pursuing reality kind of games would be more like COD. I think there is a style to, there's a style, a brightness and a beautiful world in Naughty Dog games, which is why it's worth talking about them. And I do think there are indie games that are beautiful, but unless you have a certain quantity of content, you're not going to get lost in that world and really lose yourself in the way that you lose yourself in the incredible, like, there's an entire zoology in Horizon Zero Dawn.
Yeah.
Of these robot dinosaurs, you know what I mean? And so if you're with, you only have so many resources as an indie, so you're either going to focus on having a breadth of content, like an entire zoology of creatures, but you can't afford to also make them all stunning and really think them through all the way, or you're going to have a beautiful world that's very, you'll focus on the beauty and you'll limit the scope as far as breadth goes. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think it does make sense that with, that when you think of what the most, stunning worlds are, the ones that you get lost in, I think it makes sense that you think of AAA. I don't think that's necessarily, an unusual thing. I mean, at the end of the day, like, it just takes a lot of people to achieve some of this stuff, to achieve the very best in some of this stuff. That being said, there's things that you can do with a smaller team that are stunning in very different ways. The one large team making a very large game is going to have kind of a kitchen sink game, a game that doesn't really offend people or bother anyone, maybe, or at least is, that's not true. It'll be a game that's designed to hit as many people as possible. It won't be as niche, and it won't be the singular vision of one person or a handful of people. Whereas if you have something that's very, indie games can be very powerful because they can be very specific. The Flame in the Flood, it was a beautiful game that had one very specific art style from one very specific artist. And we could achieve that because we only had three artists and we all only had to really follow Scott Sinclair, and Scott Sinclair modeled and textured everything in the game. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that brought about a certain sort of cohesion that I think is very difficult to capture in a more AAA game. I don't know where I'm going with that. Yeah, but basically, yeah, I think it's just two different things. You can have a beautiful game if you're an indie, but I don't think you can have a beautiful world that you get lost in the same way. I just think when most people think of these beautiful games, they think of getting lost in this massive universe, and that's just not something that's super attainable as an indie.
Stardew Valley is a one-man show game.
It is, both, yeah.
Pretty and has some serious scope.
It's not my favorite art style, I have to admit.
You know what's funny is that I bitch about pixel art all the time.
I just don't like pixel art. Like, I just don't like it. I want to badly. Everybody else loves it. I know. Sorry.
There's a lot of times, even with Stardew Valley, where I'm like, it's lovely for what it is.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It's personal. But
there's a lot of pixel art games where, like,
there's so
I'm
many
like,
of them.
Man, it was fucking cool, but, duh. And voxel. I don't like voxel art either.
I mean, it's. Okay, so there is something to, you're a small team, you need to be able to make a game. You want a message that there's different strategies here. You can have a game that's very simplified. How do you make it not look shitty? You can make it kind of simplified, but it might look like a mobile game, and you need to message that your game is harder or that it's serious in some way, that maybe it has a message, maybe it's just very difficult. You want a message that this is an indie game, and you want to set expectations that it's an indie game. So you make it pixel art. Like, there's a lot of reasons to make something pixel art versus, say, cartoony, or just obviously you just don't want to have bad art, right?
Look, I know that there's a PlayStation exclusive coming out that very much so has some bad art. And they're like, they're hyping the shit up out of it. And I'm sitting here going, ugh, animations.
You're not a fan of that Volcano High game, are you?
I think the story is going to be so cool, but the fucking art style is just going to make me want to. I'm glad I don't buy PlayStation, because I just throw the TV off the wall and be annoyed the whole time.
There was a couple of games. It was funny because you said that, and I immediately like flashed about three or four games from their lineup right now.
Fucking animations.
Mostly just two. But like, I don't know. It is personal taste. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about being indie is that you can make something that's extremely unique and you can take that risk. You can make a game that really appeals to a smaller market segment that really wants that game. And you can do it by having a unique art style in that way. So that art style might be a massive turnoff to you, but that's okay. They don't need to appeal to everybody. You're just not for that game.
Yeah. There have been plenty of times where I've done reviews and I'm like, look, I know there's somebody that thinks this is cool, but it ain't me. That shit just happens sometimes.
Different strokes for different folks.
But nobody should like anime chins.
Your obsession with anime chins. Jeez.
Such a pain in my ass.
Oh, my Lord. All right. Well, I know we've been chatting for quite a while. Gwen, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about that we didn't bring up?
No, if it's time to plug my stuff, I'll tell you where to go to follow the game instead.
Yeah, give us all the info. Tell us, where can we follow you? Where can we keep up to date with you and what you're doing?
Sure. Elevator pitch.
Sweet. I have to pitch me like it's a person. My name is Gwen. No. Oh, God, this is like Shark Tank. You can probably follow me on Twitter if you do Twitter. I'm Dire Goldfish on Twitter. You can definitely follow me on Twitter if you do Twitter. If you don't, then I don't know. Follow me somewhere else. I'm on Discord. You can get that from my Twitter, which is, again, Dire Goldfish. If you are interested in Lab Rat, you can go to labrat.study to sign up for the beta. The beta will be happening in about, I don't know, probably 2 months or so. Maybe more, maybe less. I'm not entirely sure on. And I'll slowly be dripping people into that and testing the game on you fine folks. Please sign up for that if you're at all interested. Labrat.study. And yeah, Kine is out right now. I don't know when this is airing, but it's on sale right now in the Epic Game Store and will be for the next 2 weeks.
Well, it'll be out on Wednesday. So.
Oh, yeah. The podcast will.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So plenty of time. Plenty of time for people to pick up Kine on sale on the Epic Game Store. And it's on all platforms. So,
yep, it's also on consoles. It's on Google Stadia, and it's coming to Steam later this year.
Nice. All right. Paul, any other questions?
No, I think we're good here.
Nothing you...
I look, do you know, like, if you let me go, I'm going to rant and go on a tangent and just be like a four-hour interview, so... I'm sure,
yeah.
I'm sure Gwen needs to do something that's real other than listen to me be starry-eyed.
Yeah, and we have a party cast coming up, and you know Purnell's going to talk for a while.
This is going to be like a seven-hour show.
Yeah, it will. So, Gwen, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on chatting with us. Everybody else, stick around. We're going to take a quick break, listen to a little bit of music, and we will be back with more show. Gwen, do you have any final words to end the interview?
Nope. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. Another thanks to Gwen at Chump Squad for joining us and chatting. That was so goddamn fun, wasn't it, Cole?
That was, especially for me. Probably more so for me than literally anybody else, but it was wonderful.
Yeah, I knew you would be excited when I got the email about a potential interview with her, and I remember just telling you, and you're like, yes, please?
Which is a big deal, because I can be really apprehensive about interviews, because I have social anxiety.
Yeah, 90% of interviews, you're like, yeah, I could do without this. I'll show up. I have to.
Yeah, I don't have a choice, so I guess go ahead.
Who's this person that got Cole to get excited about an interview?
Cole, would you like to explain who Gwen Frey is to Pernell and Chris? Who are here, by the way.
Is hello.
Currently running her own studio, Chump Squad, but previously she co-founded the Molasses Flood and worked on The Flame in the Flood. Ooh. And if you're not familiar with my love for The Flame in the Flood, first
you haven't been paying
to
attention.
Show.
I just referenced that game 2 weeks ago.
I fucking love it. It's one of my most favorite games ever, like top five, easy. And that says a lot for somebody who has 3,000 hours in The Division.
Imagine if they added the extended Flame in the Flood campaign with seasonal content.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Don't talk about seasonal content.
There's already an endless mode, so I'm in so much trouble. Just because there's four achievements that I am lacking from having the game 1K'd. And, like, I don't know why, but because we had the interview and I went back and reinstalled the game because apparently my 400 hours weren't sufficient enough in my brain, that I reinstalled it and I went back to it. And then I was like, oh, I could 1K this now. Because when I played it, the achievements were glitched.
Oh, but they're
not anymore. And so I could theoretically.
Did they involve the endless mode or something?
Two of them. One is for going through the entire campaign without killing an animal.
Mm.
And if you played the game, you know that you need bear skin for fur to make clothes, or you'll freeze to death in the later levels. And then the wolves are just a nightmare. And how to get through it without throwing bait at the wolves, I will never know. But
you throw bait, right? Because it doesn't, as long as you don't
it's tainted bait, so it kills them.
Oh.
Yeah. So you can't use the tainted bait. Your best bet would be, well, no, because then you can't even capture the rabbits because the wolves would kill them and use the, and that would count against you for having used them as a decoy. Yeah. So you can't even do that. Your only option would be use a torch and like scare them back, because they won't come near you if you got a torch.
Okay.
But so there's the one for going through the campaign without killing an animal. Then there's two for endless mode for going 40 days with only eating meat and 40 days only eating plants.
Wow.
And then
marks.
There was one other one I'm missing now. I can't think of what it was.
Not going through 40 hours of the campaign without eating anything that casts a shadow.
Oh, go through the eat everything gross in the campaign one time. So spoiled meat, moldy lumps,
lady lumps.
If you're gonna, the thing is, if you're gonna
reminds
do that,
me of college.
Yeah,
I had to reference that.
If you're gonna do things like that, then you have to be like far enough into the game that you have, access to dandelion and sumac tea so you can heal yourself, because that shit will kill you.
So has they all be eaten in one run, or is it just throughout the course of your time playing and eat all the bad stuff?
In one run.
Oof.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's really tough, because if you don't have the things to get rid of whatever you're about to eat, then you're dead and you've got to do it again.
But hey, at least you get to hear that song. Flame in the Flood, going to river.
As you could tell from this conversation, Cole likes The Flame in the Flood, and she got to talk to one of the creators, so she fangirled, and it was adorable.
I did. I was just like, please tell me about everything you've ever done in your life.
It's like, well, last night I made a banging chili.
Fuck yes. Was it a chili flood? Were there little islands?
Cooked over a flame. Over a flame. You wouldn't believe.
I am nodding my head in disapproval. Chris, what have you been up to?
Oh, not much. Still doing the grind. Finally got my copy. Somebody, Rootbeer, was mentioning that M2 is going to be doing, I guess, or somebody's going to be doing another Darius collection. I finally got my special edition Darius Cosmic Collection, which is the console and arcade port. Like, I ordered the special edition physical version back in November, and I just got it this week.
Damn.
Yeah, it is worth it, though. I mean, they couldn't help it. They had to shut down everything due to COVID for, like, months.
No.
So, you know, it was a... Oh, dang. I'm going to get it wrong, because there's two small batch... Yeah, I'm going to get it wrong. I'm not going to say who put it out until I look, because I'm going to say the wrong name. But yeah, so it's I'm really excited about that. And also, interestingly, I'm about to send my 3DS off to get hard modded for streaming.
Oh,
yeah. So that I'm pretty excited about that, because I've always wanted to be able to, like, stream 3DS, and plus it lets you play it on the TV, if you're into that too.
Oh,
yeah.
Now you have me interested in this.
I think you need something to, like, do a go-between for playing it on TV, but, like, those, you know, they aren't hard to get, and you can, like, make them yourself, because it's, I think it's, like, it uses the Raspberry Pi thing. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to learning about all that. There's, like, one guy out in Utah that I know of that's still doing the hard mods on those things, and he's, you know, his shop's open for a limited time, so, because his parts are, you know, in stock or out of stock, or I'm sure his calendar gets full.
Yeah.
So, you know, just opened up today, so I was like, well, we're doing this.
Nice.
Also, Strictly Limited Games. That's Strictly Limited. Small batch. Yeah. There's another one called, like, Special Reserve Games, and because... They both
there
start
are
with S.
So many, like, tiny, independent...
I know.
Like, small print run niche publishers that it's ridiculous. There's too many of them.
Limited.
Yeah.
You better
What's up, Cherry Rose? Thank you for dropping by. How are you doing tonight?
Premium price one-time discount games.
But yeah, like, the... You know, Strictly Limited, I like them because they're handling, like, they're out in Germany or something like that, but they're doing, like, the big physical releases of, like, all the Taito stuff that's coming out. So, like, they did Bubble Bobble for Friends, which I Catherine ordered for me for Christmas, and it got here in, like, June. But it's also great. Like, they package these things with, like, soundtracks, physical soundtracks, hardcover books, like, all the stickers you can eat. Like, just all kinds of good stuff.
So,
I like them. I deal with them, and I deal with Limited Run, and that's it.
Yeah, Limited Run is pretty good.
Yeah, a little limited. They're kind of like, I like them now that they do not limited. Like, it's only limited on time, but you can just order it any time in that window. You don't have to, like, unless it's one of their special things, like, you don't have to, like, you know...
Sit and refresh only for hours and hope exactly that you get
that's
in.
That's the way it should have always been, honestly. It never made sense to me that the non, like, truly limited bundle setups were, like, limited prints, because they got to ship the order number to the factory anyway. It's like, well, maybe the order number should just be based on how many orders we get. I don't know.
It's like, keep putting them out there until they stop selling out, and then fill in those orders, and everybody's good. I don't know. Whatever. Logistics is hard. I know, I've worked it before, but still.
Yeah.
I do have 5 things from Limited Run coming to me at some point. So.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
The only big thing I have coming in the mail right now is I picked up the Final Fantasy XII Collector's Edition from the Square
that's
Enix
we were
store.
About that.
Yeah, the, awesome. The remake for PS4. I already had the game, but it comes with, like, its own unique steelbook that was only in this special edition, and busts of the judges from the game, which I'm sure they're going to be, like, super tiny because it's Square Enix and they always make it look big and you get it and it's tiny as hell. So I can't wait to be massively disappointed. But instead of $200, it was $80. So I've wanted that thing for like 3 years now. I saw the price drop and I jumped on it.
Oh, hell yeah.
See, Joe bought that and he sent me the link and he's like, Parnell, it's on sale. And I'm sitting there like, yay, I would like that too. But then I made a dumb purchase like a day before he sent that link and I'm still sitting on like the whether or not I should keep it or get rid of it. So I was like, well, I finally replaced my 2008 Windows 7 laptop with a new laptop.
And I mean, that's like good, though.
That was a smart idea.
Maybe, because it's not, this was like, I went all in. I was like, I don't want to get a cheap laptop or a sale one. Like, I want to get a good one. So I went and spent a lot of money on it. So now I'm like, I got 1 week to decide if I want to take it back to the store in a manic panic or not, or if I'm going to just like deal with it.
Hey, so, now you could get Game Pass for PC.
Yep.
Perhaps.
Fire up that Windows 10 store.
Ignore everything that's not La Mulana.
Who said the secret word?
Well, I didn't know Sans Thesis was in here, so I had to throw it out there.
The magic word, Game Pass. Fucking Game Pass.
But yeah, like, I figure if I'm going to keep this thing, I'm going to probably open it on like Friday so I can get it running or something, because if my deadline is Monday, I want to make sure it friggin' works.
You haven't even used it yet?
I'm staring. It's in the box.
What the hell?
In my living room with the Hey, I'm weird, okay?
Turn it the fuck on. Use the thing.
Get it out of the way. I'm a crazy man.
How do you get a new computer, get home, and not immediately tear that son of a bitch open?
The thought of like, but what if I shouldn't have bought it? And I was like, well, here's the thing. It's like, if I get through the 2 weeks and don't have a damn heart attack, then that means that I was comfortable enough to just keep it and I should just start using it. But I was like, but
you
what
have
if?
Willpower, man.
Wow.
When I got my new computer, like, I still haven't even wiped my old one. It's just sitting behind me.
You can do the thing where you turn between desk and run them both.
I have to hook it back up so I could wipe it, and because Ashley's going to use it. She's going to take the old one. And I don't know how you couldn't just tear the thing open and start using it. I would jump on that immediately.
Was your new computer a laptop or a tower?
Tower.
Oh, see. This is me all laptop-y. And that's the other thought. I was starting to question, like, should I just take it back and then get a tower? Yes. I was like, I'm already used to getting laptops. I'm just comfortable with them.
Excuse me, sir. Let me preach to you the beautiful ways of PC.
Oh, Jesus.
they do the same work in the end. It's just, I mean, the laptop I got upstairs lasted me for 11 years, and it's technically still running. It's just outdated.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in that regard, it's like, back when I first bought that laptop, I was originally of the Tower Brigade, and I was like, this laptop isn't going to do much. It's going to overheat, and it's going to burn out. Or basically, I had all kinds of thoughts in my head, like, I won't be able to upgrade it because you can't switch parts out of a laptop. But then again, I was like,
you can upgrade them to an extent, just limited.
No.
Yeah. But it was like, even with that in mind, like, I got through that entire period of time and never once was like, crap, I better switch something out of this or I better get another thing. I was like, I'm content with it. It did its job the whole time. And this is the top of the line laptop. Like, this is like laptop quality right now. So I was like,
I'm technically inclined enough that I would never be satisfied. I'd be like, yeah, but I could get a stick of RAM for $20 on eBay. Or it's got an M.2 slot, so I might as well, you know.
Like, I want to get more RAM. I just don't know what kind of RAM I need because I'm dumb.
I can send you a thing and it can tell me and I can show you what to get.
Yay.
Yeah.
Either pump it up RAM or Stepmania RAM. One of those
two. I can do it for you. Easy peasy. Peasy.
Beautiful cover, girl.
Yep.
I'm glad you did it. That way I didn't have to do it because I was holding back. Like, don't do it. Don't do it.
You know what we should do?
Talk about games?
Yeah.
Shit.
I just want to go on record as saying I was talking about games.
That is true.
You were, Chris. I'm proud of you, Chris. You
strike the record. We can't have Chris looking like the good guy here.
It's true.
Okay, well, we'll start with Purnell. How's that?
That's true. I should never be. I'm the good guy by default because I'm just that awesome. But at the same time, No, I'm the good guy. Let's go.
I'm the good guy. First game to talk about tonight is called Tamarind, developed and published by Chameleon Games, released September 10th on PS4 and PC for $39.99. Leap into action and discover nature in Tamarind, a third-person action-adventure game set in the beautiful Nordic scenery starring the world's cutest monkey. Pollution and destruction from ever-expanding insects set the agile monkey into a fight for his family's survival. Rennell, tell us about Tamarind.
Tamarind is a weird game that reminds me a lot of Jet Force Gemini. Because, you know, the whole crazy-ass insect army thing. But Tamarind is a game where you portray a tamarind, which, for those who don't know, like Joe said, it's a freaking cute monkey thing with fur and shit. And the purpose of it is that, you know, he's originally at the beginning of the game, he's living at home with his adorable tamarind monkey family. And then suddenly the insect nation attacked with fire. And they pretty much torch the entire forest, kill a bunch of birds, and kidnap his family. Why? We don't know. It really makes no sense why they would kidnap his family. But ultimately, they ravage his home and just trash it. It's almost like a Captain Planet villain came to town and wrecked things. So somehow Tamarind escapes. He doesn't die. And he goes off on a mission to rescue his family. Now, as you're running around, this game plays kind of like a typical 3D platformer. He can run, he can jump, he can do a backflip. He has a long jump maneuver, but for whatever dumb reason, it can only be used in scripted zones. Like, it'll be a spot where you see a ledge across the way, an arrow will show up on it, and you do the long jump, and you'll jump over to the ledge. And those are the primary elements of his mobility right there. However, very quickly into the game, you go into an environment and you come across a little mole friend of his. And the mole friend's talking about how afraid he is of the evil insect army and how he doesn't know what to do. But then he takes faith in the little tamarind monkey because of how brave and cute he is. And as a woodland creature friend would do, he offers him an Uzi. So he's like, hey, take this gun.
An Uzi. I did not see that coming.
No one did. I sure as heck didn't. When you gave me this code and I loaded it up, I was like, okay, cute animal platformer. And then this freaking, like I said, like it's not even a mug. It's more like a porcupine. But he's like, here, have this gun. I'm like, what? And it becomes a freaking third-person shooter. So at this point, you start going down the way, going from point A to point B, and ants and other insects come at you with firearms. They start firing bullets at you, and you can pretty much lock on target or kind of like, you know, hold down the button to get the reticle up, or you can move it around, or you can running gun at the enemies and shoot them down and kill them. The goal at that point is just to not die, kill the ants by killing them. And when they die, they'll drop guns that you can pick up to recharge the ammo for your firearm. And sometimes they'll also drop like these like little insect tokens that will disappear if you leave them on the ground too long. So you want to rush to get those if you see them. Aside from that, there are also elements of like collectability, a la classic, you know, like 3D platformers. You can collect fireflies, which the way they work in this game is that they don't just sit idle. A firefly will be on the screen, and if it sees you, I actually haven't quite determined whether or not it's a thing of it seeing you or if it just knows to leave. But ultimately, you'll see the firefly, it'll see you, and it'll fly away to another location. You have to kind of chase after it and eventually do a pounce maneuver where you hold the trigger and then press the jump button, and you can collect them. They're used to open up firefly gates to get the different areas, whether they're mandatory areas or secret areas.
Chase them? Why don't you just fucking shoot them?
Well, you would think so, but then they'd be dead, Joe.
Just graze them. You don't have to kill them.
I'm sure. I love how you think a grazed firefly is going to want to help a tamarind at that
take
point.
Take out like, a kneecap.
Like, hey, I need you to open this door. Fuck you, monkey. I open no doors. You shot at me. The next collectible is a bird, another living collectible in that they're not just a stationary thing. The way the birds work in this game is that they'll usually be in a zone. And if they're in the area that you're in, you'll hear the bird tweeting, which gives you the indication you should be looking out for them. If an area has enemies and you kill all the enemies and the bird feels safe, it'll come and land so you can collect it. Other times, the bird will actually be in harm's way. And if you miss aim, you'll shoot and kill the bird. So you want to make sure you catch the bird, kill the ants or monsters around it, and save the bird. And then other times still, they'll be pretty much held hostage by, like, I guess hunter ants, I'll call them. And if you don't act quickly, their sole purpose, their sole goal is to go and kill the birds. Like, they'll just pop them. And you're like, no, don't kill the birds. And you just run out there, you know, getting shot at because you're too concerned about the birds to worry about your own safety, which is pretty much what happened every time I saw that situation. I just took so much damage. Didn't care. Save the birds. And when you collect the three, every time you collect three birds, you can take them to a birdhouse that's on one of the maps in the game. And if you put three in that house, a firefly will show up. You can collect it. So more secret stuff.
After you shoot it.
After you shoot. Stop killing them, you monster.
Hey, they gave me the gun. I'm going to use it.
Woodland creatures with guns, what are you going to do? Kill the birds. And the fireflies.
Don't kill them. Just take out the knees. Just clip a wing, drop them, collect them there.
When collectibles don't do what their collectible things, what they're supposed to do, because they don't give two shits. Just
do what that's you're told, bird.
The plight of living
collectibles. Fire a warning shot. If they don't listen, clip a wing, collect them. You're good.
They'll have to get like 12 birds for one firefly because you had to, we don't know where the fireflies are. Tell me! Yeah! Jesus crap. Timer of the game, we kill the collectibles. Actually, I guess that's technically true because you can kill the birds. I did have to admittedly go to the actual company's Twitter because I was very concerned about what would happen if I killed a bird, like if it was gone for good. And someone was kind enough to say that if you kill the bird, leave the area and come back, like leave the actual stage and come back, you can try again to catch the bird. I wasn't doing that, though, because I still was like, no, I need the bird. So I was doing full system resets or full game resets every time a bird died because I wasn't having that shit. But, like, essentially, that's the flow of the game. You go to a location. You're progressing through the zone with your gun, killing animal, killing insects, enemies, saving birds and finding fireflies if you can, and getting to the end of that zone. And then hopefully eventually the end of that area will lead you to one of your tamarind siblings or just the entrance to another area, in which case at the end of the zone, the game will tabulate, you know, how many collectibles you found and how long it took you to beat the zone. But the game definitely gives the impression that you'll eventually get other abilities. Well, I won't say give the impression because it does. But I'll say it for the perspective of a first time player, though. It gives you the impression when you beat a level that it's going to give you abilities that you can use to come back later and explore further. So even though the game's going to tell you you found like 10 out of the 13 birds, you weren't meant to find the other three birds because you don't have the means to do it yet. Well, you haven't unlocked the ability, like a zone, like a secret element yet or what? So, or an ability. So as you play through the game, every once in a while you'll come across the porcupine friend. He'll come out of the ground and he'll talk to you. He might give you some direction on where to go. Or he might just ask you for a number of collectibles. And if you give those to him, he'll give you a new gun, or he might unlock a level traversal element. So you can like get to areas you couldn't get to before. And then the other thing, which I think is actually kind of annoys me about this game, but I guess they made this choice of their own accord for some reason, is when you are in a situation where you have the firearms, you don't get the backflip and all the platforming traversal abilities that you had in the other areas. They take those away from you because apparently the platforming element, or the, I should say, not the platform, but the exploration element is kept somewhat separate from the gun element. So, every once in a while you'll come across the mole guy or the porcupine guy and he'll go, hey, you need to traverse this environment. Do you want me to hold on to your guns for you while you do it? And if you say no, then you can't do it because you can't backflip and long jump and all that stuff. So it's like a weird design choice for them to separate the two concepts. Like, is it really that hard for the monkey to flip with a gun Is it any less believable that he can do that as he is switching guns on the fly? He has no pockets. Where is he holding 200 bullets? I mean, that's just me, though. I mean, it's just so
unrealistic when you think about it.
It really, really is. Like, there's the explanation there. I guess maybe they didn't want to double dip on some of the button usage. I don't know. But they can't claim realism because, again, it's a tamarind shooting guns. Like, you got nothing. Giant ants, anyway. So that's even stranger. But it's weird, though, because, frankly, the beginning of the game felt a little jarring. I was like, okay, cute monkey. Fiery forest. Everyone's dying. And now I got guns. I'm shooting ants. It threw me off for a bit. But then once I got into the rhythm of the game, I treated it like a game. And when I say that, I mean, I was doing what you do when you do when you play a game. You enjoy it. You kill the bugs. You find the collectibles. You progress to the stages. And with that in mind, the game is honestly fairly competent. I had a few weird moments where the camera got a little wonky if I walked up into a corner or something like I didn't want to.
Are you telling me the camera in a 3D platformer had some hitches with it?
I know. Isn't it a freaking shock?
I'm blown away.
It blew me away. But aside from that, like, I genuinely didn't have any issues with this game in a number of ways. Like, if I were to say things I would do to improve it, well, obviously they're not going to combine the two gameplay elements because they did that as a design choice. That wasn't a bug. So that's not something they're going to change. But it would certainly be nice if there was some kind of map in the game because, even though the gun areas can get fairly like straightforward on the pathways, there are branching paths at times and it gets a little weird at times. You're trying to figure out, okay, which way should I go? Which way have I not gone yet? And you're trying to juggle the two things. Also, if there's like a collectible that you couldn't get on your first pass, it'd be nice if you could refer to a map and say, where was I before? Okay, go back here. And then just traverse that way on the map. And it would just make it easier to not get lost. I wish they did something like that in this game. Also, the checkpoint system could use a little work because there were definitely a few times where I would go to a place on the map, given the situation I just described where you don't have a map, so you're kind of walking forward, you hit a checkpoint, and you're like, but I also unlocked another door in the room back there in addition to this one. I should go see what the heck was in that room. So then you go back to the other room, you go through the whole thing, and then you're like, okay, now I've done all this, time to go activate this checkpoint, but it turns out you activated another checkpoint that was earlier than the previous checkpoint, and you can't reactivate the checkpoint that would be farthest ahead from where you are after getting all that stuff when you backtrack. So you just did like 10 to 15 minutes of platforming and you can't checkpoint save it. And then you get shot by a giant bug in the face and I do it all over again. So I was like, damn it. If only you just let me reactivate the checkpoint, that'd have been great. But nope. So that would be nice if they could do something about that maybe. But for the most part, I enjoy the game. Like they should tell you how to unlock bird cages when you see a freaking bird cage. At least just tell you, because they do enough button-up prompts where they'll say at the bottom, press this button to jump, or you can jump across this ledge by pressing this button, but meanwhile you see a bird in a cage, and you're shooting at it, and you're jumping into the cage, and nothing you do knocks the cage down, and no prompt comes up and says, you're not equipped to unlock this bird cage, come back later. Just give me that. Give other people that are not sitting there wondering about if they're missing a collectible, if they should be looking for a switch or something. But but for the most part, I think the game is definitely serviceable. I think the game is taking a lot of flack online that I honestly kind of don't think it deserves. Like, it's clearly not, I'm not going to go so far to say it's like an 8 or a 10, but I think it's like at least a 6 or a 7. It's a competent, fairly fun game.
So $40 sounds like a try it.
I think it's a try it.
Sounds good. I wish it were a little cheaper. I think 40 seems a little steep for the game, but I haven't played it, so I don't know if the content's there to justify it. What are your thoughts on that?
Honestly, I wouldn't be so far to disagree with you there, but the thing about games, especially in the current age, is that they go on sale, and they go on sale a lot. So even if that launch price kind of sucks for folks, there's no harm in waiting for the sale and then buying it then. I'm sure the developer is going to be happy if they get a sale regardless.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just I'd say as a from a personal from an individual, I'd say, of course, wait for yourself. But for me personally, I would probably wait to get it on a sale too, because it's not really doing anything I've never seen before, and it's not making my socks fall off when I play it. I'm like, holy shit, did you see how I shot that ant? Or I caught these fireflies. Like, it's not doing anything that just makes it stand out. But no. Its package is competent, and when you start playing it, you will enjoy it.
All right. Big shout out to A Loud Snore for dropping 20 bits.
Dropping bits!
Is it another new name? I kind of figured, but I didn't want to say anything.
Oh, I'm not the reason for that loud snore. I was very enthusiastic about that review.
He's a sleeper.
So what's the story behind the new name now?
He keeps making mistakes and committing to the bit.
Jeez.
Also, Lightspeed is the name itself is like on hold for 6 months because of where he changed it. And so when the time was up that he could change from Prayer Hub, he still couldn't change back to Lightspeed. So.
Oh, man. All right. Next game to talk about tonight is called Voltron Cubes of Volcarion, developed and published by Gabanga, released September 10th on Windows 10 for $18.99. Voltron Cubes of Volcarion is an action-packed one-on-one real-time strategy game where you take your role of your favorite paladin to battle AI or other players online. Chris, tell us about this one.
Alrighty. Well, you know, full disclosure, I have not actually seen Voltron since the 80s. So this Same. Is, and yeah, and this is very much based on the new Legendary Defender series that came out a few years ago. So it's got a little bit of that style. And of course, a DreamWorks animation splash at the beginning where I was like, ooh.
Fancy.
Fancy. But anyways, that's okay, though, because you don't actually need to know anything about Voltron to enjoy this game. Not a single thing. In fact, it's very, very light on the Voltron content. As you know, Voltron is usually a giant Megazord, for the lack of a better term, for us 90s kids. But no, it's Voltron is like a bunch of lion machine vehicles that, you know, combine together to form the big guy. And, you know, each pilot is like, you know, a character in the show. And it's just all about that. None of those are in this game, as far as I know. What is in this game are a bunch of cubes. The cubes are given a backstory, interestingly enough. I can't tell you what. I guess the Olcarion are a race of alien people that can make really elaborate, like, metallic cubes instantly. And I don't know, man. Is it somewhere in there they explain what they are? That doesn't matter. What it is it's kind of like a combat puzzle game, and it's kind of like a real-time strategy game. Now, you can see on the screen that Joe's pulling up here, but this is audio, so I should explain, that there's a grid on either side of the screen. And your character is on the left and your opponent is on the right, and your base is to the far extreme left of the screen, and there's on the right. The idea is that you have to do damage to their base 3 times in order to defeat them. So the way that you do that is that in those grids, in each of those little blocks that appear there, you have the option of building a different cube. And each cube does something different. And, you know, some of them work in with certain restrictions and things like that. So you can make basically a solid steel cube that does nothing, but it's your structures. And, you know, of course, you can build on the cubes like in any way. Like, you can go sideways. You know, if you build up, then you can then build over. Like, you don't have to, like, you know, make a you don't have to, like, have a block under every block, you know?
No.
Like, if you make a big, like, upside down L, that's okay. not really okay, strategically speaking, but we'll get to that. But it is allowed. So, you know, you got, like, your blank blocks. You've got fire shooters or fire throwers that, like, you know, shoot a fireball in a straight line. You've got, like, freezing blocks that will freeze the enemies, their blocks. And if they reach a certain amount of frozen, then they can get destroyed. You have interesting ones like a crawler box, which actually And so when you click on it, a little critter comes out and then runs over to the enemy side and sabotages their stuff, like takes down like some of their blocks and things like that, unless they're taken out, of course. And then you get the drone block, which is a great one. It sends a drone into the air and, you know, it goes over and wreaks havoc and, you know, is from certain angles indestructible. So it's like an angel of death sort of. And but the problem is that they're so hard to set up. And that's where the real challenge of the game comes in. It's not like you're at the same time you're building this stuff, you're defending yourself against what the enemy has built. And there's two different things that you have to keep in mind. One is that every block that does something has a cooldown. So you got cooldown timers on everything. Not only that, but you have a certain level of quintessence. Now, that's actually from the show, according to Wikipedia. And quintessence is something that it's these lights that are around your cursor. And every time you build something, it uses up one of the lights, and then the light has its own, like, it has to power up again. And so you can't just sit there and build up like an entire, you know, Lego set while you're, you know, just clicking quickly. Like, you have a certain amount of things you can do in a certain amount of time. The other thing to pay attention to is that some blocks can't be blocked from a certain angle. So if there's anything in front of your fireballs, then it will get, destroyed. And if there's anything blocking, like, your critter box, like, if you have anything on top of the critter box, critter can't come out. Same thing with the drone one. So you have to, like, be very particular about where you build stuff. And again, you're dealing with enemy fire the whole time, so you have to pay attention to what your opponent's doing. If they're building a fire block, then you know that fire block, even if you built one, like, right there, like, unless you time it just right, you're probably not going to be able to take that thing out before it gets a shot off. So you might build, like, an emergency block right there just to absorb a blow and then, you know, do something else. And that's the thing, is that any block that gets exploded, every single block that is on top of that block comes down. So if you build, like I said, like an upside down L type of shape, you know, you just like make a stem go up into the air and then like build everything else on top of it, then if that stem gets hit, then everything is going to come crashing down. So you have to like use the landscape, as it were, like, to your advantage. So it gets really complex and it's really intense, because like you're sitting there watching timers going down and you're like, oh shit, I need to do something with this. I need to do something. There's the drone. I need to, and you know, there's so many cool things that can happen. Like, there's an air blower block that will, if you actually do put a fire block like behind it, then it will actually, or you know, in range of the air blow, it will actually blow the fireball up. And if you actually time it, there's a tutorial for this, by the way, I'll get to that. But if you have two fire blocks and you shoot one and then you shoot the bottom fire block and then you air push it up into the other fireball, it creates a double fireball. And the game hints that you can do this with just about as many of those things as you want. So you can, like, you know, set it up to where you make just this giant fireball of death. There's so much that you can do in this game. It's like, that's the thing, is that it becomes kind of intimidating when you first start playing. Because even on easy mode, the like, opponent's no slouch. So you really have to kind of learn on your toes. And that is to say, you know, all this stuff that I've explained, like, you can learn all this stuff and actually practice it with 10 different tutorials, like, wow. 10 rounds of tutorial stages. Yeah. And the game also has a straight up one-on-one where you just pick your character. There's all of the paladins from Voltron, Legendary Defender, and then there's three silhouettes. So that means, I guess, when you get to a certain point, you can play as the bad guys or something. I don't know. And you can pick, like, just a one-on-one battle, just a regular melee in whatever stage you want. Again, half of those stages are locked away. And then there's a mission mode where you go through and, you know, try to complete, like, very specific missions with specific parameters and things like that. So, yeesh. It is a very, very good puzzle game in terms of, like, complexity and what it allows you to do and how high they raise the stakes for, like, actually learning this stuff. Like, and it pays off. Like, the first time, like, I'll tell you, I lost a lot of rounds, but then when I won my first one, I was like, elated. This is, you know, it was an incredible thing to like actually outsmart the enemy. Again, completely on easy mode, but I'm telling you, it was a pressure cooker of a state of a thing, and I was really glad to have won it. So, yeah.
Well, $18.99 on this one. What do you think of it?
This one is really cool. I actually think it is a buy it. I think, don't worry whether or not you're a Voltron fan or not. I'm sure there's something tucked away in this game that may, you know, really appeal to Voltron fans. But honestly, the storyline and interactions are pretty minimal from what I could tell. And, but the action is so there. Like, it's a really, really good, like, realization of, like, its concept. So yeah, I'm gonna say it's a buy it.
Awesome, sounds good. And if people are kind of on the fence and tentative about it, keep an eye out on our Twitter. Carnage and I think we're going to be doing a giveaway for a couple copies of the game, so
oh, yeah.
Keep your eyes peeled.
Oh, and it is multiplayer, online and I think local.
Yep,
so there you go.
Good stuff. All right, next game to talk about is called Minoria, developed by Bomb Service, published by Dangan Entertainment, released September 10th on Xbox One, Switch, and PS4 for $19.99. Ink and blood stain the streets of Ramesia. Witches must burn and sins must be judged. Venture forth as Sister Samilla to burn down the pillars of heresy in Minoria, an action platformer by the creators of Momodora. Pernell, tell us about this one.
This game, this will be a short review, I think. So, the game pretty much takes place, pardon me, this game takes place where you are pretty much exploring a castle ruin, not a ruin, but I guess a castle and landscape under siege by a witch army, and where you are controlling a nun and her companion, seeking out a means of which to save the various princesses scattered throughout the castle. It controlled the exploration function is sort of like a Metroidvania style game, with you finding locations that you can't quite access until you either find a key, you defeat a boss, get an ability, you know the deal. But the thing I like about the game is primarily just the atmosphere and the aesthetic. And of course also the combat. The main character has very fluid movement. She has a melee attack with a sword. Eventually she gets like charge attacks from physical with her physical attack, where she can hold down the button and then let it go for a full slice. She can parry, which means if attack comes in, you hit the button at the right time, you can kind of stun counter them and do massive damage to them, almost like they were enemy crabs. And you could also do normal roll dodges by just, instead of hitting a parry, yeah, you knew I was going to do it.
Like an enemy crabs. That's a sign, because we're talking about fight crab later.
So. See, I'm good. And you also, of course, if you don't feel confident enough in the parry, you can just do a typical dodge by rolling towards or away from the opponent when a strike comes in. In addition to your normal attack and your charge attack, there is also equipment that comes in the form of incense. Whether you purchase it from an NPC in the library, like hub area, or you find it hidden on the ground in one of the exploration areas, you can equip incense. There are two types of incense that you can equip. Passive incense, which can bestow a like a sort of passive buff on the character. Like, for example, it can be something that says, like, restore, you know, 10%, like, hit point, 10% of the damage done from an attack as hit points. Or, you know, increase the invincibility frames, you know, when you, you know, do a dodge roll or something like that. You equip these things, they stay on and provide you with passive effects. And then there's also the actual, I guess, equipable incense that you have to actually activate on screen. And this can range from attacks, such as fireballs or lightning spells, to buffs or healing abilities. And you can switch between up to three at once, and you can use the trigger button to kind of rotate between them to decide which one you want to use at any given time. And each incense, whereas a lot of games like this give you an MP gauge, these skills are actually limited by quantity. So you might find an incense, that incense, due to the type of attack it is or whatever, might give you, you know, 10 uses of it. So up until you get to another save point, you get 10 uses of this incense, and when it's done, it's done. Up until you, again, get to a save point and restore it. You can, of course, switch off that incense for another item if you want, or just do what I did and not be a sucker and just use your three incenses until they run out and then hope you get to a save point. But I was like, I don't want to abuse the system. I want to do it right, baby. So that is primarily the game. You're running around this area, fighting monsters, and locating secret areas, which actually do exist in the game, surprisingly. Like usually in the form of like walls that like will push back if you kind of attack them or hug them, which will unlock areas that have hidden items and stuff in them. But every once in a while, you'll also come across a boss encounter. There are two types of bosses that I've come across. There will be large-scale bosses that fight like your average monster in a like Castlevania-style game or whatever, where you got to go hammer down and just beat the tar out of it and dodge the attacks. But every once in a while, you'll also be just fighting a witch. And the witches are humans like you. And you're fighting, and they kind of fight as if they were like a player character. I mean, like they use like melee weapons, they use magic that may as well be incense. You get the point. And somehow, some way, those are the bosses that kick the crap out of me. The big boys, they're large targets. I'll mash on them. It's easy to dodge roll them. But when you fight the witches, all of a sudden that parry button isn't just for show anymore. Things got to get utilized, and they will beat the tar out of you over and over again till you get it right. Unless, of course, you've already got a high-level proficiency in games like that, in which case, have fun being the dominant boss on these battles. But I'm not that guy. I got mudholed until I got it right. And I'm fine with that, because that's kind of a cool thing. It's nice to play one of these games without having to change the difficulty setting to get a challenge. So, honestly, I found the game to be plenty fun. The combat is even more fluid, because if I remember, Mom, from my memories of Momodora, you fought with that leaf, and though the combat in that game was fun, the leaf felt kind of heavy when you used it. So you were like, wham, wham, and it was very slow and deliberate, whereas the sword in this game, you feel it moves very fluidly, and when you make contact with an enemy, you can kind of, they visually display the impact the sword is making, and it's kind of nice. I appreciate that. I just genuinely think the game is a good time. The only thing that might concern some folks is that it's a bit on the short side, but I'm of the camp lately where there's so many good games out there and so little time to utilize to play all these games that sometimes you can get a game that gives you a solid experience in a short amount of time, then that in itself is worth it as long as you're okay with spending the money to get that experience. And I think this game is worth that money.
Well, $20, your verdict?
I think it's a buy.
Cool.
Momodora.
No, Minoria. Momodora is the other one.
Momodora. I know.
Oh, man. All right. Next game to talk about is Outbreak Epidemic, developed and published by Dead Drop Studios, released September 10th on PS4 for $12.99. The infection goes nationwide in Outbreak Epidemic, an action-focused co-op survival horror adventure. Alone or in two-player local co-op, fight through the campaign story mode, the wave-based onslaught mode, and the all-new experiments mode scenarios. Choose your survivor class and level up to unlock new buffs for your survivor as you face the nightmare. Serlina and Chris, you're Serlina wrote in a review, and Chris, you're going to talk about it. We'll start with Serlina. She says, "Happy Tuesday, SML friends and fam. It's Serlina, and I know you're surprised to hear from me, but Joe Cam's got a girl really busy this week, and I'm here to review Outbreak Epidemic on the PS4. Developed by Dead Drop Studios, Outbreak Epidemic, which I will call Epidemic for the remainder of the review, puts you in the shoes of four survivors who must do everything they can to escape the nightmarish horror of the undead. Let's start with the review. Epidemic is the second of the Outbreak titles they've released on the PS4 this year, and if you may recall, I did review Outbreak The New Nightmare. You also don't need to play The New Nightmare to enjoy Epidemic. The stories are self-contained and are only connected in the fact that this all happens in the same universe. The characters don't seem to be connected to one another, which is fine with me. I'll discuss the differences, though, as I feel they're important to mention. Epidemic has fewer characters, but that doesn't affect much. There's still variety in the gameplay because each character has two classes. Epidemic has offline co-op and no tank walking. These are big pluses for me. The walking actually feels natural, not very clunky. However, Epidemic also doesn't have a map, and the paths are nowhere near as wide. Big minuses. Strafing is super important in this game, and the fact that I can't do it effectively because I keep running up against walls and fences is annoying. Epidemic does have bigger inventories unless you play a character where less inventory slots is his debuff. This is really nice because I like to stack my ammo and allowed me to have choices in my munitions. I still had to worry about inventory management, so that wasn't lost. I also like the fact that you can do between arcade mode, which gives you more drops, and realism mode, where resources are really scarce. I played on arcade normal mode and still died many times, even though I was swimming in coagulants, which are only useful if you're bleeding.
There's a difference between painkillers and coagulants, and you specifically, if you take regular damage, a painkiller fixes that. But if you're taking bleeding damage, then you have to use a coagulant. Both of which take a full slot in your inventory.
Nice. That is always convenient when something so tiny takes up a full fucking slot. And a goddamn grenade launcher is the same size as a pill.
Well, it's not quite. The grenade launcher takes up many more slots. But still, it's as tiny as the inventory is, you really feel the pain of like carrying around healing items.
Oh, man. Anyway, she continues on. There were some things I didn't care for, though. The game's super dark and you have to have a light source. Luckily, each gun has a flashlight, which can be toggled on and off. Unfortunately, each gun also has a non-active position, and this makes that flashlight useless. For example, the handgun is always facing forward. You can always see. The shotgun tilts to the left when you aren't actively using it, so you can't see what's in front of you. You can always aim to use the L1 button, which is now equipped with a fancy laser, but when you're aiming, you move slower. Finally, I did encounter a bug or two. The reptilian enemies get stuck quite a bit, which is fine for easy dispatching. I saw one literally just running around in circles, which was great for giggles. I hope she recorded that. Also, there was some tree distortion, like the branches and leaves were clipping through buildings or blacked out entirely. I'm not quibbling, but it's there and it exists, and you should know about it. Outbreak Epidemic is available right now on the PS4 for $12.99, and should you buy it, I will give the game a try it. Again, this sort of gameplay is not for everyone. The game is still hard, and your aim will have to be on point to escape from these scenarios. I do feel like there are elements that were done excellently and others not so much. The game is filled with pros and cons, but I still had frustrating fun with it. Chris, what are your thoughts?
I'm largely in agreement. I can't really think of anything besides, explaining the difference between healing items. I can't think of anything I would contradict in that email. So a few things I would add. For one, you definitely like this game is really stingy on inventory, and I feel like that is to its detriment because of how much like stuff is just laying around that you have to ditch. Like, it's kind of nice that you can, if you pick up a gun, like let's say you have a handgun and you pick up a second handgun, you can either drop the bullets out of that handgun and then put them into your handgun, or you can like combine them. It's a little frustrating because that stuff's not very clearly explained. They give you a tutorial level, but it's just like the first level. I guess it just ends after a while. I don't know. But anyways, so, you basically have to like kind of commit yourself to like trying to load up like a couple of guns. And the thing is that even on easy mode, the zombies that are coming after you, and I always have like a problem with this, there's no cannon fodder in this game. Every enemy takes like 5 to 6, like sometimes more shots to take down. And if you're playing in arcade mode, you can just basically sit there and pat bullets into them like as, much as you can. But then like, even with the best shotgun character, you get a shotgun and there's like, there's this kind of like, I guess it's a lizard enemy is what the email described it as. And, you have to shoot this lizard guy in the face, like even on arcade mode, like, the other mode, by the way, the realism mode, like makes it to where only headshots work. Everything else just gets absorbed into the zombie. So they, jeez. So I kind of left mine on arcade mode too. But yeah, like you're sitting there, like you actually have to take down, like shoot each of those lizard guys in the face 6 times with the shotgun. And the shotgun only holds like, less than 10 like bullets in total. And so every time you dispatch one of these enemies and, hope to God there's not a group, you have to like backtrack and go find more ammo that you left behind. You have to remember where you left it. But yeah, like the game advertises itself as being extremely difficult. So that's not a complaint. That's just, that's something that people should probably know when getting into this game. Here's a complaint. No inverted Y axis. No option for switching that control. And
dead drop. Always, what are you doing? Invert Y. Give us the option.
Everybody, every game out there,
ever.
everybody out there making a video game, if it uses the y-axis, make that shit invertible.
Allegedly, Mario Sunshine ditches the inverted camera and you can't change it on the All-Stars version.
Oh man, I'm gonna have my mom cancel my pre-order.
Yeah, I'm pissed after hearing that. Like, I don't know if I'll be able to play the game like that.
Yeah, I don't know, because I only played like a little bit of Sunshine, and I have it on the GameCube, so at least I can revert to that if I need to.
Nah.
I'm picking it up just for posterity, because I'm just like, I need this. I have literally all three of these games sitting right here, and I don't need this, but I need it. Anyway, that's getting off track.
Just a little. $13, Outbreak Epidemic, what do you think?
I think that it is a try it as well. I think that it's definitely an ambitious and well-done project for the fact that it was made by one person.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, there's some frustrating bits to it, but I think that it actually is like, it's low res fun. Let's call it that.
That works. Cole, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, finally, when it boils down to games not having inverted, that's when you guys have to finally understand what's like for me when I see there's no sensitivity option.
Yeah, for sure.
Only my hands hurt. I can still play the game, but my hands are going to hurt. You guys are just like, I can't do it. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, note to all developers, the more options we're given, the more we're going to praise your game, even if it sucks.
Yes.
So that is, there you go.
If there's any one thing to spend time on in game dev, even if you're riding solo, it's accessibility.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Agreed.
All right, well, next game to talk about is called Spark the Electric Jester 2, developed and published by Fepard Games, released September 7th on Xbox One for $19.99. Following right after the ending of the original Spark the Electric Jester, you'll take control of Fark, now in the third dimension, in his quest to find out his true identity, speed through several fast-paced platforming stages, action-packed bosses, and fully animated cutscenes. Pernell, we never got the first game, so I guess the story is... Do they explain it?
I honestly didn't even care. It's it's your Fark, who's the fake Spark, and you talk to animal people, who's a professor who gets kidnapped by another guy who looks also like Spark, but not Spark or Fark. He's Eli, or again, it's dumb. But the gameplay—that's what Pern's here for, and just to cover the base for whoever's listening, I wasn't a big fan of the general Sonic the Hedgehog storylines either. It was like, look, he's a hedgehog who runs very fast. I want to run fast too. Let's do this. But as far as the game goes, I was very pleased by this. And it was a complete shock to me to see it come down the pike too. So for those who don't know, Spark the Electric Jester, the first game, was designed to play a lot like a classic Sonic the Hedgehog 2D games. Left to right platforming, speed elements, zip lines and tubes, blah, blah, blah. This one, on the other hand, is designed to play more like a 3D Sonic game. I ended up likening it to a combination of like Sonic Adventure and Sonic Heroes. Sonic Adventure, due to like the Sonic levels and how they flowed, but Sonic Heroes, due to how the level breakdown plays out, because you end up with like two stages, both of which are different, but they kind of share a theme, and then you fight a boss, and you get some story, and then you do it again. Two new levels, and then a boss, and some story, and you do it again. But the game actually does a fairly good job of handling like the whole speed elements of like a Sonic 3D game. Fark is capable of quality speed. He runs very quickly. When he's in the air, he gets a homing attack, but unlike Sonic, he only can trigger it when there's actually an enemy present to attack. So you're not going to like be doing a lot of like just random bumps in the air. It's like, jump, is there an enemy there? Good, I can do it. So you do a homing attack and you nail him to keep you moving. And then pretty much the game is consistent of like you going from the beginning of the level to the end of the stage, hitting zip lines, bumpers, the general, speed mechanics that a Sonic game would have. However, unlike more modern Sonic games, there is no boost button in this one. So you can't just like hold the button down to get a massive burst of speed at all times. You have to pretty much maintain the momentum by controlling him through the stages themselves. So, also, I forgot to mention, he can also do a wall jump in areas where it's relevant to do wall jumps. Now, the element that makes Spark stand out from Sonic is the fact that they try to place more of an emphasis on combat in this game. Typically, in a Sonic game, you can come across capsules, and those capsules will contain bonuses like rings, or more commonly, or more desiredly, shields. Whether it's an elemental shield in the classic Sonic games, or just a generic shield in the more modern ones. However, in this game, rather than give you shields from breaking boxes, you gain access to, I guess they're forms? I don't know what the technical term is for them, but essentially they're like different attack styles. So you might come across a capsule that when you break it open, you get a ice sword. One that might give you a fire sword and roller skates. You might get one that gives you a hammer that you can charge up to do like a cool hammer attack. And you, aside from those power-ups in general, your base form can have like a light attack, a heavy attack, and a charge attack. Now, all of this is on top of the fact that the game is supposed to be maintaining heavy momentum with speed. So, to me, when the game is handling that, you're trying to blitz through stages as fast as you can. I think that's when it peaks. I think that's when the game is at its most fun. But it bugs me whenever I'm trying to get the momentum going and there's enemies that show up that I can't hurt through my normal, you know, homing dash or whatever. So now the game wants me to stop with the momentum and start melee attacking these guys until their hit point gauges go down. And then they blow up. As you can probably tell by the lack of enthusiasm in that statement, that's the part of the game I do not like. Like, I get that I'm sure there's people out there that have played Sonic games and were like, you know, it'd be better if Sonic had to fight more. And I mean, we kind of got that with the Werehog thing when they tried to implement that. And I asked if he was okay with the Werehog because they made a decision that a lot of people hated, which I was okay with, which they divided the levels up into, like, you know, platform and combat stages and then platform and speed stages. That way, if I'm going to go for a speed level, I'm getting the speed. And if I'm doing a combat stage, it's going to be slow, methodical combat. I'm fine with the break apart. But when you combine the two, it feels kind of janky. So on the positive, though, much of the time, you don't have to fight a lot of guys. Like, there is a score challenge you can do after you beat a level for the first time where you can go back and beat up as many enemies as you can to manipulate a combo counter and get a high score for that if you want to. There's also a mode where you can, like, go back and do a high speed challenge and get to the level as fast as you can. So if you're like me, you're like combat, barf, you can technically kind of avoid it, except for like the rare time where you might get to like a gate that's blocked off. You got to defeat the gate guardian to open it to get to the next area of the stage. But even then, that's like something you can kind of just like mash your way through. I didn't mention those power-ups. And I forgot to mention that you don't lose particularly the power, the previous power, but you collect one. They actually go onto like a dial at the bottom, and you can use the cross pad to switch between the form you want. So if you collect the form, it goes into one slot. You can just switch to it as you see fit. So you don't have to really all that, be all that concerned about, oh crap, if I pick up this one, I'm going to lose the previous form. This is for the folks who like the cool, think they'll like the combat. You don't have to like be agonizing over which form to keep. Because you'll get to keep them all, and you just use them when you want. So that's kind of nice. Overall, I think, honestly, I found a lot of fun with the game. The momentum is definitely felt when you play this game. The music, I would like to meet the composer for this game, because I have been bopping it all week. It is very good music in this game, especially Floral Highway. That is my favorite track in the game. It totally gets the whole Sonic, modern Sonic OST style down. I know a lot of people like to hate on it. I am not one of those people. So I was very fond of that. Genuinely, I think the only thing about it that really bugged me is, again, like the fact that they try to hit the fighting combat, the combat within the speed stages, which I thought was kind of like, again, like I didn't like that pairing. And I also just wasn't too big on the plot, but that's also me. Maybe I'd have cared more if I played Spark 1 first and then brought and moved into the second game. That's very possible because it is a direct sequel.
Yeah. Maybe if this does well, it'll spark the inspiration to bring the first game to console.
Oh, I'm inspiring you to tell terrible jokes. Join me, Joe. Join me in Crap Joke Town.
overall, $20 on this one. What do you think of it?
I think it's honestly still a buy, despite what I said about disliking the combat, due to the fact that you can blitz stages without engaging in a ton of it, And the bosses themselves, well, Sonic games had those kind of the bosses too, and you got through them. It's not a game killer. I think it's still a solid buy and worth your time if you're into, like, you know, Sonic style gameplay.
Nice. I might have to check this one out myself. It looks really cool.
It is. I think you'll like it.
Awesome.
Oh, one last thing to mention. I should say this, though, and I think it's worth pointing out. It's important, which is that in Sonic games, you're probably familiar with how sometimes the game will make you, like, go like a high speed section, and it'll kind of put Sonic on rails, so to speak. So he's like moving with the game so he can get through the zone. Mm-hmm. In this game, quite a few of the sections will make you go fast, and they do not rail you. You have to control him and maintain his, you know, his positioning on the platform. So just wanted to throw that out there. You will be challenged on some of the platforming and running sections too because of that.
So pay attention.
Exactly.
All right. Next game is called Golf Zero, developed by Colin Lane Games, published by Rattleika Games, released September 8th on PS4, 9th on Xbox One, 11th on the Switch for $4.99. Golf Zero is a cute, fun, and original little game with a mix of clever golf platforming gameplay. What starts as a relaxing outing on a grassy 2D golf green soon turns into a crazy physics obstacle course. Do you have what it takes to earn the gold medal? Cole, what did you think of Golf Zero?
So, I gotta be perfectly honest here. I am typically pretty anti anything golf. Like, the moment it says golf, I'm like, bitch, I'm out. And I just don't have any headspace for it. But Golf Zero is less golf, more platformer. And so it's far more doable for me as far as playing it goes.
I'd even call it, like, twin stick shootery.
Yeah, it does even have that kind of element. Not in like a top down kind of capacity, because it is side scrolling as a platformer. But it has the golf element of the game. Like, if you're looking for, you know, pick a club and putt and go, you're not getting that.
No, just, you should look for PGA 2K21 that we reviewed the other week.
Check the fuck out now, because it's, you know, what I would have normally done otherwise. But the fact that I played it and 1K'd it should let you know that you're not playing a golf game here. So for the actual golf mechanic, you need to A, jump, which then, once you jump, you press X to hit the balls, and this slows down time and puts like a time wheel around you. So that time wheel shows how long you've got while you're in slow motion. And during that time, there will be another arrow that you can adjust and then press the button to hit your balls. You get 3 balls per level, and physics plays a big role in it because you need to arc them motherfuckers just right to get them in the hole. It's a hole in one or bust. Well, a hole in 3. Yeah. You get 3 balls per level. But the problem is that this is a puzzle platformer, and sometimes you don't even get to shoot the ball at the hole first. So you may not always have 3 shots to try to score and finish out the levels. You may actually need to use the balls to hit a switch to open the door, so that then you can get through to the other side and then try to score. That's the easy baby level beginner stuff with this game. Okay. Like, hitting the switch so that you can shoot across is like tutorial level, because this game gets absolutely insane in classic Rattleika fashion. You don't have to finish the game to get the achievements. You can stop at level 41. And I will tell you that I stopped at level 48 only because fuck, it got insane and I couldn't do it anymore. I barely got as far as I did. I always try, and I was so disappointed that I had to tap out when I did, because there's actually a whole second section, like an act 2, if you will. And I was just like, my hands are done. I'm out. I can't do it. So I didn't even get to play all of that. If I had to guess, I would say there's gotta be hundreds of levels in all. Which is really fucking impressive. I don't remember. I remember looking, but I don't remember what the actual number was.
We know there's at least 48 stages.
Yeah, because I made it that far.
Yeah.
No, because I remember there were beyond 50 something, and I just was like 48, and I was like, I got the achievements. I did the best I could. My hands hurt. Because it's very Super Meat Boy level hard to actually get through some of these platforms. So I was impressed at how fully fleshed out this game was and how it was actually such a unique take on both platforming and golf. Because I didn't think I'd ever see a golf game where I'd be like, fuck yeah, that's different. But they did it.
Yeah, this one was really fun.
Yeah, and it was so unique and quirky that I was like, I'm down. There even gets to a point where like you're not just trying to clear the level so that you can shoot the ball into the hole. You're flat out like racing against a little demon monster that's chasing after you, and like trying. And not only do you have to get it in there while avoiding the goddamn saw blades and hitting the balloon so that you can get a gold medal and all this shit, you have to outrace this little demon fucker. And I'm like, I'm done. I can't do it anymore. There's so much going on, and it's so unique and creative that it's, this is one of those games where I go, a lot of times I say, Radalika often finds the way out there obscure stuff that you would never see on console otherwise. And we kind of shit on them for like, but I don't do it. But like a lot of people will shit on them because, they just put out easy achievements and it's a money grab. But that might be the hook. The reality is a lot of times these games are actually really super cool.
Yeah. I don't think they would get attention on console if it's not for Radalika.
They really wouldn't. And you can't knock Radalika for knowing their market. Oh, you want a $5 easy completion? Let me show you this. And then before you know it, it's 3 a.m. and you're being chased by little demon things while you're trying to slow motion knock golf balls into a balloon on the other side of some saw blades to get a hole in one.
Well, $5, your thoughts?
I would say fuck it. Why not? If it weren't so good, it actually deserves a buy it. It's a buy it.
Nice.
Yeah, I had a great time with it. And fuck, I hate golf.
And again, for real golf, EGA Tour 2K21.
Yeah, there's options. This is just like some weird shit you pick up in the middle of the night and you're like, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm having a good time.
This is when you want golf and you're tripping on acid.
Don't be surprised, though, if you're one of those people like me who literally will just run into the saw blade, same blade, 19 times, yum, chop, yum, chop, and I'm like, God damn it. And then I put the controller down, and I go get a pop, and I come back, and I beat the whole level one fell swoop and get a gold. I don't know. I'm one of those people.
I am proud of you.
Oh, for real golf, you're going to want Jack Nicklaus's greatest 18 holes of major championship golf.
Oh, man. All right. One last PartyCast game to talk about is Weakwood Throne, developed by Nelf, published by Dragius Games, released September 11th on the Switch for $4.99. Something bad happened in Weakwood Kingdom. Furious beasts wandering the fields, people getting more miserable each day. It all started since the new king reigns. Find out what's wrong in the throne room. Chris, tell us about Weakwood Throne.
Okay, well, this is a Dragius game, so if it's still this week, I would invite you to go onto your, you know, Switch eShop and look up Dragius Games and look through their catalog. If you can afford a candy bar, you can afford their entire catalog. Because they're those guys that, like, their games frequently go to the below pocket change price. You know, like 9 cents, 19 cents, whatever. Things like that. So I'm pretty familiar with them by now. But yeah, that's the publisher anyway. Apparently the developer is another one-person development team.
Nice.
As I understand so. Okay, so this game is a Zelda-like, basically. You are a kid? I don't know. There's a problem. This game does not communicate, like, anything. But you are a person of some indeterminate age. You have a stick, and you have a skateboard. And you are traversing a fantasy land where skateboards, I don't think, exist. So I'm kind of confused as to why you have a skateboard. But hey, it's fun. And basically, yeah, you just go through this game and you try to, you know, it's like Zelda, so it goes from screen to screen, right? So there's like a certain playing field, and then when you move to the border, then as long as there is something else there, then you shift into transitions into another screen. There are enemies that you have to fight at first with the stick, and of course, as you find towns that have like weapon sellers, you can then purchase your next weapon and use that to defeat enemies. Now, at this point, this is where it kind of diverges into like a few different paths you can take. So you have, you have basically three stats in terms of like, you know, you have strength, dexterity, and magic. And every time that you, when you defeat enough enemies, gain enough experience, or do enough quests, you gain a level. And then you get 2 points that you can dump into any one of those three stats. Those stats are essential, like in a Diablo-style game, in being able to equip the next weapon. And I do mean it. Like, you basically, like, the requirements for just getting a sword with, like, 2 more points of damage than your current one is, like, 3 levels worth. Like, it's, you actually really have to commit to a certain skill tree, in order to get, like, any decent weapons. But yeah, I decided to go with strength and dexterity so I could equip a bow. Right now I can equip a bow that is called the weak bow, and the flavor text is, this bow is used by kids. So, whereas my sword is actually a guardian sword, which is like a soldier's sword. So I'm kind of like, I'm wondering if I'm just wasting my time putting anything in dexterity, but you know, that's what canary playthroughs are for. So anyways, yeah, it's pretty interesting. Like, you get, you know, you have a menu that is, here's a complaint early on, though. You have a menu that is, like, you scroll through it with the shoulder buttons. So the R1, L1 buttons are for scrolling between your stats, which is also your level up screen. Your inventory, which you then use the bumper buttons to scroll between weapons, armors, stuff, and quest items. Stuff is like consumables, like potions and ingredients that you find from chopping plants and arrows, etc. And then you have your quest log, which is all of your quests that you have, and I'll get to those in a second. And that's the thing, you know, you push the X to get into this menu, but more importantly, you push the X button to get out, which is not normal for RPGs. You know, normally you push the B button, right, to cancel mm-hmm. out of an inventory. If you push the B button and you have an item highlighted, you drop that item.
Oh.
The drop button is B, and the use button is A. So don't use any of those buttons unless you actually want to use a consumable or drop your sword or whatever. I dropped the sword in the middle of a fight.
Oh, man.
That was such a bummer. And it's not changeable or anything because, again, this game is very light on options. But yeah, we'll get to that. So yeah, basically, that's just a minor complaint, but still, be forewarned. So you walk around in this game. The one thing, and I feel like this is a pretty big oversight. So there is a tiny map with icons on it that tell you things that you need to know, such as where, you know, there might be a boat in a stage with a lot of water, because there's a little boat icon. And boats actually are kind of hilarious because, you know, when you're riding on a boat, like, this is a top-down view, right? The boat turns, but your character doesn't. So I think that's just a funny thing that happens in games like this sometimes, and I just love it. But yeah, then, you know, there might be question marks, and if the question mark is glowing gold, that means that it's either a quest that you've completed or one that you're about to take on, that you haven't taken on yet, and so that's the person you want to go and talk to. And if you don't go and take quests, you're going to be very lonely in this game because you can't talk to anybody unless they have a question mark on their head that is glowing. Which, you know, it's talking about, like, you know, the game advertises itself as like, we'll, you know, you learn the story through dialogue and blah, blah, blah. Like, you can't talk to people. What are you talking about? All you do is like, when you talk to them, they're like, please, please give me 10 sunflower seeds. And then you go to the next screen, chop down 10 sunflower seeds, bring them back to them. They're like, oh, thank you. Here's your reward. And then they just ignore you for the rest of the game. So I don't know. And that's the thing, is that I would like to say that there's like this bigger story that you can uncover or that you can aim towards, but there, the big oversight in this game is that there's no overarching map. An exploration game that is Zelda-like, even the original Zelda for the NES had a world map. You just couldn't see any details on it, but you at least knew where you were. In this game, you just keep walking up until you can't walk up anymore, and then you know you're as far up as you can go. Because you can walk across all the water, or use a boat. You can skateboard across all the land, or, you know, just hoof it. But, like, you kind of don't have a good... You have no sense of where to go, because the game doesn't instruct you on anything. Like I said, you know, if you get into a new area and there is a question mark on your mini-map, you can walk towards it, and then hopefully that will get you going. But apart from that, it's kind of like, oh, what do I do? Where do I go now? I guess I just walk around until I find another question mark. But having said all that, like, these are, you know, these are oversights, but the game that is here is pretty nice. The action, it feels pretty good. It's basically kind of twin sticky. You know, you swing your sword when you push the RL button, or, you know, the R button, the bumper button, whatever you call it, the big squishy one. And, you can aim your strike somewhat with the left stick. And if you're shooting with an arrow, then you can, you know, you have a laser line that works pretty well. There's a day night cycle that doesn't seem to affect anything. I guess it affects what, NPCs might be on the map at a certain time, but I haven't really seen it change that much. But, and the art is actually the strong point of this game, because the art is great. The enemies are very cute and or interesting. There are so many different kinds of sharks in costumes and crocodiles and like crabs with big curly mustaches and, you know, things like that. Like, there's a lot of little details in like the, in the character arts that I really enjoy. You know, apart from that, the game looks inoffensive. I mean, it's very cartoony looking. I think it's cute and functional. And actually, the leveling up system is pretty, it does draw you in. So I would say that for its small development team and also for its very low price, this is better than I was expecting. But of course, it has a few things to go before I would consider it like a full game worthy of me shaking down people in the streets saying they have to try it.
Well, $5, what are your thoughts?
$5, I think it's worth it. Just know that, you know, there's different things in it that, you know, there's not a whole lot of engagement with the player in terms of like story. There's no overarching map. Given that this game is based on like a kind of Zelda-like adventure, there, I really wish they would have ripped them off more instead of trying to be totally original.
Yeah.
And, you know, my own, like I said, my moral of the story in terms of like what I could tell a developer is, please don't deviate too much from control styles that we're used to in your indie game. Like, make B the cancel button if you're going to have a menu in your game. Or, you
There's
know,
some industry circle. Standards that just stick with them.
Yeah. And again, accessibility options, you know, when you pause, you can do continue or main menu. That's it. Like, and then, you know, in the, you can go to a separate settings where it does actually have like a couple of things, you know, you have different languages, vibration, you have an auto aim, which is nice. That's pretty cool. But yeah, like, you know, there's no controller options. There's no way to change that. You know, audio and sound are yes and no, and then they each have like, you know, a slider, and that's it. Yeah, it's just things like that, you know, give us a little bit more on in that term. But apart from that, yeah, good job on this game. I think it's a good buy it for somebody who's looking for a cheap adventure game.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is it for the PartyCast crew. Thanks to you three for being here. I'm going to let you go. Tim Akabis is coming on to talk about two games. So... Oh, I don't want you there. I don't want you there. It's just going to be me and Tim. That's how I feel.
Fine. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sleep. I'm going to dream about Freddy Krueger. And you know what? We're going to play video games. and you're not invited. Be him in the claw.
Doesn't Freddy Krueger kill somebody in a video game in their dream? In one of them?
Yeah, was, I think the fifth one?
No, but the sixth one was the...
Oh, the sixth one? Dead.
Yeah, back then it was probably one of the coolest kills because I was young and loved video games, and now I go back and watch that, and it's like, that's cringe. Be like me, be like me, be like me. I'm not like you, Dad. I'm a cool kid, like video games.
Oh, boy.
And a bunch of his clones of his dad beat him to death with rackets. And at one point, Freddy Krueger breaks out the power glove and he goes, it's really bad or something like that. Either that or it's like, now I'm playing with power. It's one of those lines. It was cheesy as shit. Dude, I'm going to look that scene up just to confirm that that's what he said.
No.
Like, now I'm playing with power.
I'm pretty sure that's the line. Yeah. It was pretty fantastic. But yeah, anyone have any final words before we switch over to Tim?
Now I'm playing with power wasn't good enough for you.
Now you're playing with crabs.
But well, get that checked out.
All right, and finally tonight we are ending the show with Tim Ekibis. Tim, how are you doing?
Save the best for last.
Always
on this show.
Always.
Yeah. Not always. Sometimes I'm on at the beginning. But you know, this time I'm back to schluffing off to the end of the show, closing things out strong and hard.
I mean, we started things strong with Gwen, good interview, and then there was the party cast. Purnell was there, so of course things went long.
Yeah.
And then we're wrapping things up with you.
Yeah. I just like how we're making fun of Purnell just all over the show these days for his endless tangents.
Hey, you're not one to talk. You did a, 35-minute Avengers review?
Review? That was the topic at hand.
Yeah, true.
Come on.
Still, that was a long one.
It was. There was a lot to talk about. Hey, one of those, that's like, what, Sekiro was a long one, Soul Calibur 6 was a long one. Them big AAA games.
Yeah, they deserve the time.
Yeah, there's a lot to discuss in those.
Yeah, you got two to talk about tonight. No triple A's, but
nope. So yeah, we'll be done within a decent amount of time.
Set the timer. We're gonna wrap this up quick. But you ready to dive into these?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Next game to talk about tonight is called Fight Crab, developed by Kalapa Games, published by Mastiff, released September 15th on the Switch for $19.99. You are a crab, embark on a world tour of devastation, flipping over as many crabs as possible in a quest to be crowned Lord of the Crustaceans. Tim, this one's had a lot of hype behind it.
Has it? Yeah, a lot of hype.
you've been excited for this one for a year now.
Yeah, I know. Like there was like a glimpse of it in like some kind of a sizzle reel like last summer. I don't remember whether it was Xbox or Nintendo or Sony. I don't remember whether it was E3, but like I saw it somewhere and I was like immediately like, Joe, Fight Crab, me. Like, this is my shit. Yeah, Fight Crab. First rule about Fight Crab is you don't talk about Fight Crab. And the second rule of Fight Crab is you can talk about it if it's for a review or, I guess, an interview. Are we doing that on Thursday?
Yes, we are. Next episode.
Yeah. All right, next episode, we're talking to the developer of Fight Crab.
Well, not developer. We'll be chatting with David at Mastiff.
Oh, David at
publisher.
Mastiff.
Yeah.
The publisher of Fight Crab. Well, good thing I don't have to tell him his game sucks. It'll always be awkward. Yeah, I know we scheduled this interview, but it turns out our reviewer just didn't like your shit. So anyways, yeah, Fight Crab. This game is great. It is a sort of arena. You know, you want that intense arena combat, like, you know, virtual on, you know, like that, except your crabs. No, but yeah, it's sort of like an arena combat, physics-y, goofy fighting game where you are a crab. There's also lobsters in this game. It's not just crabs.
So they change it up. They keep it fresh.
They do. They do fresh from the sea. Fresh seafood. Mostly crabs, though. So you have a crab, and so each analog stick is one of your arms, your pincers, basically. So where you move the stick moves your arm in that direction, and then you hit the triggers to attack and block. So you can kind of, you need to move your claws around to block and line up for like attacks and stuff like that. And that's your basic premise of it, really. You can also grab. There's also grabs. You can grab onto your opponent if they're guarding, or pick up trees, I guess. Maybe you're really big crabs. That just seemed weird to me just then when I thought about it.
It took you that long for it.
Yeah, it didn't really seem weird. I'm like, wait, you're picking up trees? Like, are the crabs huge? I just thought they were normal size crabs. I don't think this is any kind of crab cockfight thing. I think the crabs are in this of their own volition. Like, they know what's going on. This is like ancient and respectable crab combat. This isn't like some dirty underground, like Pokemon shit. And the bonus, as I was explaining the rules, is on the Switch version, you can take a Joy-Con into each hand in order to control your crab's arms. So, really great makings of a couch versus game when you have two sets of Joy-Cons, which I was unfortunately unable to do with my son because my one Joy-Con is out to get its drift fixed.
Mm.
But, you know, I am confident in the silliness that can ensue with people of all ages given controllers to fight each other as crabs. So the single player mode of this game is... it's a world tour. It's a lineup of just like different stages that will pit you up against different opponents in different environments with kind of different weapons involved. As you go through the stages, you will earn money so that you can unlock different crabs to play as and unlock more weapons for your crabs. So yeah, there's a shop where you can buy all kinds of weapons like knives and swords and guns and tonfas and nunchucks and Mjolnirs and just chains. Like all you can like just get real nasty in here. Shields, there are shields. If you want one of those, it's the kind of deal where, like, all the weapons have stats and stuff like that, but I went to the shop first thing and I was like, oh, I want a crab with two tonfas. I'll think about the stats later, but that's what I want, is a crab swinging tonfas around, and that's what I got right off the bat.
Follow your dreams.
Follow your damn dreams. So, they'll have different statistics and properties like how large the object is, what kind of an arc they have when they swing, how much damage they do. Some are better for throwing. You can throw shit at your opponents. And the whole object of the fight, it is a little bit Smash Brothers-esque in that you are like building up a percentage and you're getting a percentage built up on you. The higher the percentage gets, the easier it is to flip said crab over onto its hard, wet back, which I am intimately familiar with from dealing with your mom.
Gasp.
No, yeah. So you got to flip the crabs over onto their back, and then there is a three count. And if they're on their back for three and cannot return to their crabby legs, they are out. They are done. So the higher you're once you get up over 100, much like in Smash Brothers, where you start flying off the screen a lot, like it'll only take a couple hits to flip you over onto your back and possibly get you counted out for the 1, 2, 3. Also, I forgot you can, as you earn money, you can also invest it into your crab to upgrade your crab stats to make them more powerful or more resilient or faster. I should mention, yeah, you use the D-pad to move your crab around, which is a little bit weird. Like if you tap in the direction, your crab will just start like circling to the left. If you double tap, they will circle faster. And if you have to click, or no, if you push both sticks in one direction, then the crab will turn physically like away from the opponent or whatever. I mean, sometimes you were fighting two crabs at once, or a crab and a lobster, or two lobsters, some permutation of thereof. So there is some need for considering your movement and positioning, and that's why it reminds me of Virtual. because you're in these arenas. You have to move and target at the same time, except it's crabs, and it's great physics-y fun. There's a decent amount of levels to it, and just you kind of never know what's coming next. I can tell you just without getting, you know, spoiling any surprises, because this one is on the title screen. There's like one in the desert where there's crabs coming at you on scooters with chains, like a crab biker gang. And yeah, it's just a really fun, just goofy ass fucking game.
Just absurd.
It's just absurd, but it is, you know, it's not garbage to play. Like, yeah, it's kind of goofy and physics-y, but it's still fun to mess around with. I would love to see some high-level fight crab play at, I don't know, some great fighting game tournament. Hopefully Evo will get its shit together.
Oh my god, Evo fight crab.
Yeah, Evo fight crab.
Oh my god.
Maybe on one of the side streams. Please, just something. I want to see high-level fight crab.
I'm there.
I think it would be great. There is online play. Ooh! Also, and I couldn't confirm this because, you know, I'm reviewing it, but it appears to have the actual built-in friends list on the Switch. So, like, I think you can actually add your friends in Fight Crab so you can see if they're online and then invite them to co-op with you or compete, because you can do the campaign co-op, which is great. And you can, of course, fight each other and you can get versus matches online. But I appreciate any game that, like, actually has friend list integration in the game so you can make use of it, but it looks like it has that. It's right there on the title screen. Yeah,
I'm not sure if it's working or not. I played Fight Crab earlier today and I didn't see you in the friend list, and I'm pretty sure that we're Switch friends.
Yeah, we are absolutely Switch friends. Yeah, I'll have to check. Like, I don't know if you, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know if there's something certain that you have to do. It just says I haven't registered any friends.
Okay, maybe you have to register them in the game first, because God forbid anything on Nintendo is not complicated when it comes to online.
Yeah, shit's always got to be crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, $20 on this one. What do you think of it?
Yeah, that's a buy it. This is a good price for, it's a good looking, those are good looking crabs, too. Good looking environments. Yeah, I think it's a ton of fun. It'll be fun for a person just to kind of play through and mess around in the single player. And I think it'll be more fun once you get some people over in your house to play waggly crab fights with.
And we definitely got to figure out how to do the online co-op crab battles.
Co-op crab battles. Fight crab.
All right. Fight crab. White crab indeed. One final game to talk about tonight is called Bounty Battle, developed by Dark Screen Games, published by Merge Games, released September 10th on Xbox One, Switch, PS4 for $24.99, PC for $19.99. Bounty Battle is the ultimate indie fighting game, a new multiplayer 2D fighter where you can pit your favorite indie heroes against one another. Indie heroes from games like Guacamelee and Darkest Dungeon to Dead Cells, Owlboy, and more battle it out in this fighter frenzy. Tim, tell us about Bounty Battle.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a good thing we're not interviewing them on Thursday.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, this is like a Smash Brothers for indie games. As you named a bunch of indie games who have characters featured in Bounty Battle. That's kind of the gimmick. There is a few original characters, but yeah, you're pulling in characters from Owlboy and Guacamelee and Dead Cells and Blasphemous and Jotun. The girl with the gauntlets from not Darksiders, Battle Chasers, is in it. Which is still eternally weird to me, having read those comics in the 90s, that's a thing at all in the year 2020. And that, you know, there is Battle Chasers games out there, game, I guess, singular, and that one of the characters is in this random ass fighting game. The dude from Flint Hook is in there.
SteamWorld Dig, Axiom Verge, Nuclear Throne.
Yeah. I was kind of sad to see the character from EITR, which is a game that has not come out yet, but, I told Joe I wanted to review when I first saw it like 2 years ago and is still in like development limbo. But the main characters in this game. So that's cool. But yeah, it's like a Smash Brothers dealy thing where you pick a character and then you put in a stage. You know, there's a bunch of stages from all these games. And then it's kind of a, it's like that, where it's like if you press, I think it's more, it is more of like a heavy attack, light attack, but you know, you click the stick up or push the directional pad up and with the button, and it does a different thing down in, you know, directions plus buttons do different things, much like in Smash Brothers. And you're beating the crap out of each other, to be the last person, last character left standing. And you know, it's cool that they got all these characters together. Like, it's a bunch of games I have played, a bunch of games I have heard of but haven't played, and then some characters where I'm just like, I don't know who you are, but I respect it. The problem is I just don't like playing it at all, really. It's kind of the big problem. I don't really like the look of the characters and how they animate. Like, there's something that just feels like a little cheap to them. I hate to say that games look like Flash, because there's a lot of Flash games that look very good. But there's just something about, like, the way they look and the way they animate that, like, just doesn't look that great to me, and kind of more with how they, like, I don't know, hit each other, and just like the feel of the combat feels very loose. There isn't like a lot of weight or impact behind the moves. It just feels like a lot of light flailing at each other. Like, there isn't just like a good sense of landing hits and comboing or the character's movement. It just like just don't feel like it comes together as a fighter, and there isn't like a whole ton of modes in the game to mess around with. Like, it's pretty bare bones. It has online play, which, you know, good luck with that. But like the single player offerings are just like a basic kind of tournament thing. The stages are fine. If like, it's more of just like a backdrop. Like, you don't really get how it is with Smash Brothers, where you have all these stages, they have different properties and different levels and different platforms. Like, a lot of, like, almost all of these are just like kind of plain planes. It's all Final Destination, basically. It's all just like straight platforms, so there's not really a lot of room to use like characters different movement and strategies. And yeah, the music, I just remember like my very first impression was, you know, picking some characters, going to the Guacamelee stage in San Luchita. So there's like this all out brawl going on, and then there's just like this very chill mariachi music going on in the background. That's just straight from the game. It wasn't like an arrangement or anything. Like, here's the battle arrangement. It's just like, just took the straight music, and just like, it just did not fit or feel good at all with like what was going on. I was just like, man, like, it's just not clicking here with me. And besides all that, like, if you're gonna get proper, you know, you look at this game and it's a party game. Its best function would be as a party game, yeah. I guess. And that, like, oh, you're gonna have people over, you're gonna pick these characters, you're gonna beat the crap out of each other. I think, like, you'd be hard pressed to get four people in a room that like have this amount of enthusiasm and have played enough of these indie games to get something out of the cast. You know what I'm saying? It's like you put people down in front of Smash Brothers and people know those characters because it's Smash Brothers. They're a bunch of timeless characters, and I'm not like putting down these characters at all. I'm just saying that like in a party environment, if you have people over, people are just gonna be like, well, who is this? Who is this guy from Darkest Dungeon? You know, just this random knight dude. So I don't think it's going to have that appeal for a lot of people just like looking for a party experience either.
Yeah, I don't think people are going to be like, oh my God, it's the character from Doko Roko.
Yeah, it's the Blasphemer.
Blubberbusters. I don't even know Blubberbusters. I haven't heard of that game. That's no knock to the game. It's just,
yeah, exactly.
There's some lesser known games here.
Yeah, it just doesn't have that like sit on the couch, hand them a controller appeal. And then, like, once you start playing it, like, it just doesn't feel good. It's hard to say anything about that when it comes to a fighting game. It just doesn't, like, the way the characters move, control, hit each other just does not feel good and engaging. It's just, like, too loose and weak and, weak, I guess. I mean, that sounds mean, but it's just, like, I just feel like I'm slapping people just gently. Like, no.
There's no impact.
Yeah, there's no impact. It's a cool idea, but I feel like it just does not come together into an engaging game that is going to be a ton of fun for, you know, having people over to party and couch, you know, beat each other up. And I don't feel like there's enough single player offerings that even if this game does click with you and you're like, oh yes, I know all these characters and this combat feels fine to me, I feel like you're gonna come up short with it that way too.
Yeah. Well, overall, $25 on this one, $20 on PC. What do you think of it?
$20 on PC. Yeah, no, I just don't think this game is. It's a deny it. The streak is broken.
That is a bummer. What would you do to improve the game?
I think it's just like the combat mechanics and the stage variety, like in terms of the layouts of them, need to change to add some more variation. And I think you just need to it's a simple thing. Just work, you know, work on that combat engine, make it feel better, developer. It's that easy, right?
And just fix everything.
That's the thing to look at is the combat is the core of it, but also I think that there needs to be some more variety in the topography of the stages.
Gotcha. No, they can't all be winners.
They can't all be. I was on a pretty decent streak the last month.
Yeah. Oh, well. But that is it for this episode. We made it through another one. Tim, thanks for being here. Thanks to the PartyCast crew for being here. And thanks again to Gwen Frey for coming on, chatting with us. It was an absolute pleasure having her on. Lab Rat, check that out. It's going to be in beta in the next coming month. So keep an eye on that. And Tim, you'll be back next episode.
I will be back next episode because I committed to doing that on Thursday night. So we're going to do it.
Indeed. Indeed.
That's what I got to do sometimes. Just say, yes, I'll do that. And then show up.
Just fuck it. Why not?
Just like, yeah, sure. Absolutely. Because
no regrets.
Oh my God. It's just the past couple weeks have just been so insane at work. It's just my brain is just so fucking scrambled. Like, I know Cole and me have been on here at various points in the last month and a half talking about the trials and tribulations of having school age children, and what that means for us. But you know, I work in a school and I could tell you just like everyone is losing their goddamn minds. Like, it is so hard at trying to get this freaking patch together hybrid learning airship off the ground, and everyone's trying so hard and they are so frazzled and just like, oh my God, we got to get through this. I think there was already a positive test in the school.
Oh no.
Yeah, just last Wednesday.
No,
I wasn't in. I was working from home that day, so I wasn't anywhere near it. But so it's like, yeah, it's great.
Well, stay safe up there.
We're trying.
Oh boy. Well, do you have any final words until next time?
I think that was enough. Really? Jeez, talking about schools and stuff. Of course,
that was a final. I'm looking for something succinct to just wrap it up.
Succinct. Ugh.